Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
About being on a merry-go-round. You know, a merry-go-round will go round and round and round and round, and if it doesn't stop, you'll remain in the same position, but in order to get off that merry-go-round, you're going to have to put in some effort. And this is pretty much what happens to us on a regular basis. Get up in the morning, shower, shave, get a little bite to eat, make a beeline to work. We get a lunch break, coffee break, another lunch break, and then at the end of the day, we go home. We do this for 360 days a year. And at the end of the year, we're looking for something different to happen financially, but we don't realize that we're in the same position that we in the year before because we keep doing the same thing. The definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing over and over, looking for a different result. And, of course, no different result is going to happen unless you put forth some effort to get off the merry-go-round. Now, one of the major solutions to the problem is to look at your current situation. If you got a mortgage, if you got credit card debt, if you got student loan, if you got a problem with the Internal Revenue Service, if you would cancel these contracts, if you have a mortgage that gives you whatever, if you're paying $800-$900 a month on a mortgage, if you cancel that, that's $900 a month in your pocket. If you have a student loan, you're paying $500-$600 a month on that. That's $500-$600 a month in your pocket. If you Internal Revenue Service asks you for $10,000 that you owe them, you cancel that contract, that's $10,000 that you don't give them. It's very, very simple math. But if we don't make any effort to get off the merry-go-round, we remain in the same position. I would like to recommend you to go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and the package is available there now for you to cancel those contracts.
Welcome, Morris. Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And this evening, we'll be dealing with the CIA, Groom Lake, Area 51, and America. And we're going to discover what that is all about. We have some very, very detailed information. We have some people who have been assassinated as a result of bringing this information. You're going to hear what they have to say before they were murdered by the Central Intelligence Agency. Are there underground cities inside the United States? Well, I'm going to answer that one right now because I know for a fact that we have one right here built in Jacksonville City. I was there when they were actually building this thing. It's a massive underground city, deep, deep, deep down, drenched into the earth. And they're building these things in different parts of the United States. We're going to find out about that. What is Groom Lake? Who control wars on this planet? What is Area 51 all about? How does all of this affect the people of North America? These are some of the topics that we're going to get in here this evening. I want to mention the fact that we're offering free articles this evening, the 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game, How to Play, Secrets of America, and so on and so forth. Where you access that is send me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, an email. Just say, Tahaka, send me those articles you mentioned on your broadcast, and I'll send that to you as an email attachment. Send that to TARHAKA53@hotmail.com, and I'll get that rush right on to you. Now, keep in mind, Mose, right here in January, coming up in January, we're going to have the Moorish Summit right here. So make sure you mark your calendar and make it on down here with us, and so that we can share the hospitality with you, and you get a chance to meet with brothers and sisters from all over America right here in Jacksonville, Florida, to the Moorish Summit that will be held here in Jacksonville. And as close as we get to the date, we're going to put all the details up there for you so you can make all the contact information, make sure you got it right, so when you get down here, you'll be right at home. Okay? Now, when it comes to debt, there's no way for you to really, really make any progress in life if you are burdened with debt. So I recommend that you go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, because we have brothers and sisters over the country that have access to the archive, and they're dealing with the get rid of the Internal Revenue Service and so on and so forth. And you can cancel these contracts. If you got a mortgage, you can cancel that mortgage. If you got a student loan debt, you can cancel that debt. And the way to access that, go over there, type in your HTTP address at www.newfreehelpgroup.com. And once you get over there, give me a shout at area code 904-303-9061. Try to call me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we can get in there and give you some guidance. We'll find out where you are, so we can best aid you in solving these situations, because we want to become unburdened from any debts and stuff that we may have inside the United States now. We want to get rid of that kind of stuff, get it off of us, so that we can have something to use to invest in some of the priority needs that we have. We might want to invest in food, water, self-defense devices. You might want to grow your garden. You're going to need equipment. You're going to need tools and all of this good stuff. So make sure you go over there and unshackle yourself from these debts so that we can make some progress. Now, what we're going to do here now is we're going to hear about how this thing affected our communities involving the actions of the Central Intelligence Agency and what happened in the United States, and what did they do? And we're going to get down to some very, very valuable information also on a letter that's been placed out. We're going to bring that to the forefront, too, so you can find out about that. And we're also going to hear from Professor Griff this evening. He has some information to drop on us as well. Okay. Now, the first thing we're going to deal with is we're going to deal with this crack situation, because we got this thing still going on inside the United States. And we believe that just because it's not being broadcast in the media on a daily basis, and it's not day after day after day they're talking about it, that this thing is going away. But I'm here to tell you that it is not going away. This thing is still with us, and we're going to deal with some of that this evening. So y'all
here is Jane Pauley.
A super secret organization like the CIA is going to have secrets. But this sounded too bizarre to be true. Yet there it was, in print, in a respected newspaper. The accusations that the crack epidemic, which ravaged this country's cities, was spread with help from a secret army linked to the CIA. As you may recall, the story set off a firestorm of controversy. Then last month, a surprising twist. The newspaper which had first published this astounding story started to back away from it. Is the story true or not? Tonight, Bob McEwen takes a second look.
We are sick and tired of your excuses.
And I hope that you will help to put an end to it, because we are tired and we're hurt and we're angry.
I will tell you, Director Deutsch, as a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, that the agency has dealt drugs throughout this country for a long time.
It was an American first. The director of the CIA, one of the country's most secretive institutions, facing the public at a town meeting in South Central Los Angeles.
If this information turns up wrongdoing, if it turns up wrongdoing, we will bring the people to justice and make them accountable.
An extraordinary event in response to an extraordinary accusation. that people working with the CIA had a hand in sparking the crack epidemic that has devastated America's inner cities. Those charges came from this man, reporter Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News. He became one of the most talked about journalists in the country, his story the most controversial of the past year, because after investigating the origins of the crack epidemic, he claimed he found a link leading right to the CIA.
Men who were working for the CIA's army were responsible for bringing all that cocaine into Los Angeles that sparked the crack epidemic.
The CIA's army, Webb says, were the Contras, the anti-communist rebels fighting the government of Nicaragua back in the 1980s, an army founded and funded by the CIA. Webb wrote that some Contra supporters smuggled cocaine to America to raise money for their cause.
The CIA has been bringing drugs into this country.
As then CIA Director John Deutsch discovered, it's an accusation that rings true for many, especially for some in the African American community. And Webb's story has taken on a life of its own.
And Gary, this
on the talk show circuit and the internet, some have even gone beyond Webb's charges to accuse the CIA of conspiring to target young African Americans.
Was the CIA willing to poison our cities and crack with crack cocaine?
On the basis of what you learned, do you believe that there was a conscious decision, a meeting where someone sat down and said, we're going to poison the youth of black America and here's how we're going to do it?
No, I don't. These guys were looking to raise money, and I don't think it mattered to them where they did it. They just went where they could raise the money.
Gary Webb says his stories were largely based on the testimony of a drug dealer with Contra connections who became a U.S. government witness. But 9 months after the series was published, the controversy continues. Some of the heavyweights of American journalism have examined Webb's work and found it reckless, often wrong. Just this week, Webb was pulled off the CIA story after his own executive editor admitted the articles oversimplified the origins of the crack epidemic and left out important conflicting evidence. He also wrote, I feel that we did not have proof that top CIA officials knew. But despite the evidence to the contrary, Gary Webb insists his stories were substantially accurate. And many Americans do seem willing to believe that their own government could have been involved in drug smuggling. So was the U.S. government involved in any way? Dateline decided to take a second look. Crack use spread like wildfire in the early 1980s. And in Los Angeles, a drug dealer known as Freeway Ricky Ross was in the middle of it. Prosecutors called Ross the Walmart of crack. He made millions in the early 80s dealing to Los Angeles street gangs. Police say he was among the first to take expensive cocaine powder and cook it into low-cost, highly addictive crack, then distribute it through the gangs. Webb says Freeway Ricky helped trigger an epidemic of human misery.
It destroyed our community. All the black men are in prison, most of us.
Rick Ross is now serving a life sentence for cocaine distribution.
The women are still strung on the drugs. Kids without fathers, without mothers.
And honestly, how much responsibility do you have for that?
A lot. A lot of it was my fault. I played the game.
Police in Los Angeles say he virtually cornered the crack market thanks to a steady supply of cheap cocaine, a pipeline so good that Ross was able to introduce crack to other cities using his gang contacts and to make himself, he says, a very rich man.
On your best day, how much money did you see?
A couple million, two, three maybe.
A day.
On a good day.
How many days like that were there?
A few. Quite a few.
Rick Ross's drug supplier did have connections to the Contras. Dateline has been able to confirm that from former Contra leader Eden Pastora. And Pastora admits he received some aid from that drug supplier. But Pastora says he was not aware of any CIA drug connection. So we asked Gary Webb, where is the evidence the CIA knew of any drug dealing?
You have to define the CIA. If you're saying that people who were working with the CIA know they were doing it, yeah. Did the director of the Central Intelligence Agency know this? I don't know.
This is nonsense.
Now retired, Dewey Claridge was the CIA's man in charge of Central America in the early 80s. He insists the agency had nothing to do with any drug trafficking or with any cover-up.
Don't give me the conspiracy bullshit. Come on. You're a more intelligent man than that. Come on. This has never been a conspiracy in this country.
Never? Gary Webb's version of events may be wrong, but in the mid-1980s, there was a high-level White House conspiracy called Iran-Contra.
Whatever you believe, Gary Webb's stories have revived interest in an issue that's been simmering since Ronald Reagan was at the White House. Were U.S. government officials aware of drug smuggling in and around the Contra movement? And did they simply choose to ignore it? One U.S. senator says, absolutely.
There's no question in my mind there is a complicity in the flow of drugs into this country, period.
A Senate investigation led by John Kerry of Massachusetts found that individuals who provided support for the Contras were involved in drug trafficking, and that one or another agency of the U.S. government had information regarding the involvement, either while it was occurring or immediately thereafter. Incredibly, according to Senator Kerry, smugglers even used the U.S. government's own airlift operation at El Salvador's Ilopango Airport to get cocaine back across the American border. This drug enforcement agent patrolled that same airport in the mid-80s.
It was just nonstop traffic coming and going. And nobody ever inspected their planes or their cargo or whatever.
Cele Castillo told Dateline he observed rampant drug smuggling at that airport.
Well, what we had was that we had Contra pilots flying out of Ilopango smuggling drugs into the U.S., cocaine specifically.
He claims the smuggling was so open it had to be condoned by the U.S. government. Castillo says planes would arrive filled with supplies for the Contras, then leave carrying cocaine for America, bound for military airfields in Florida and Texas, offloaded out of sight of the law, then shipped to California and other points in the U.S. And there's more. Castillo says when he reported all of this to his bosses at the DEA, he was told to ignore it.
So you were told point blank.
Point blank, stay away from it. It's a covert operation being run by the White House.
In a letter to Dateline, the Drug Enforcement Administration said it has vigorously investigated, and no evidence has ever been found to substantiate Mr. Castillo's charges. As for the CIA, it's denied ever aiding or condoning drug smuggling.
Reports were reaching the highest councils of our government, in the White House and in the Justice Department. There is no question of that. I can document that.
The White House and Justice Department disputed Kerry's report at the time, but he still believes some government officials turned a blind eye towards drug dealing in the mid-1980s, after the time at the heart of Gary Webb's stories. There were no indictments or prosecutions, and ultimately those allegations of drug smuggling became just a footnote in the scandal known as Iran-Contra. According to Kerry, at the time, American officials were more afraid of the evils of communism than the ravages of crack cocaine.
I'll tell you, South Central Los Angeles and every other city in America are owed an explanation. People knew that drug trafficking was getting mixed up in the flow of weapons. People knew there were bad types involved in this operation. They didn't turn off the spigot. That's plain and simple.
The CIA is reviewing the charges made by Webb and says it will conclude its investigation by the end of the year. The House Select Committee on Intelligence says it will issue its own report and that its investigation will not be affected by the Mercury News' reevaluation of its series.
Okay, Moose, we back. I remember back in the 80s, when we had guys here with so much cocaine that it was unbelievable. I mean, it was like each city or each side of town had their own factory manufacturing this stuff. And I traveled across the United States in 85, and every town that I got to in between Jacksonville, Florida, and Houston, Texas, had an abundance of crack cocaine going on. Everybody was had this stuff, man. They was going on. So I'm trying to figure out if the CIA was not involved in it, if this was not a covert operation hatched by the government of this country and involved the White House, how was it possible for people, a particular race of people, who own no airplanes, who own no ships bringing drugs into the community, and fuel all of these cities at the same time in massive quantity if they didn't have anything to do with it? If the White House didn't have anything to do with it, if the CIA didn't have anything to do with it, and the people who actually own the airplanes and own the ships and stuff didn't have anything to do with it, can somebody please explain to me how are people who have none of these transporting devices, none of these warehouses, not even the know-how to manufacture this thing from plant to product, got this stuff in their possession and all of these guns and automatic weapons and all of these cities at the same time if the White House didn't have anything to do with it, if the CIA didn't have anything to do with it? Help me to understand that. Let's go a little bit further.
It's a tough one. This is, of course, the calm before the storm, perhaps. We have so little to go on. The man's been a vice president, politician. The responsible people say, give him a break. Let's wait and see
right.
what he does. My own position, and then they say, well, he is such a chameleon, but he could go either way, so to speak. And they point out that he was historically more moderate than Reagan, who has always had a wild hair up his nose. But I personally am more of the school that I believe we do know a lot about this man. In fact, we know some things about him that are much more significant and frightening than what we knew about Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was, of course, a committed conservative who was known to have a slightly defective mind. Who
and
had
proved
some pretty,
that was the case.
And proved it and lived up to and had some harsh policies when he was governor of California. But Bush, the CIA directorship where he made these contacts, I worked for him. You know, I witnessed personally his supervising the CIA's covering up of illegal activity at the end of the Angola operation in early 1976. And he was actually fending off a hostile Congress. Instead of investigating and firing the perpetrators of crimes, he was fending off the FBI and the Congress on at least three or four major CIA criminal activities.
What were those activities?
Well, one was the Angolan operation, where we had broken a number of laws, much like the Iran-Contra and the Bolan kind of laws. And then we had conspired to cover up the breaking of the laws. And I mean literally, we sat around the big oak tables and discussed the law. We went down to the library and read up on the law. I remember one session reminding the boss, you know, don't contradict yourself. Last week you said, you know, don't contradict yourself. This week, if Senator so-and-so brings up a certain issue. And this one, he just plowed right into that one. And he was just telling the Senate, you know, the Congress, I don't know, I wasn't here, but I'm sure that I just find it very difficult to believe, but we'll look into it thoroughly. If you'll just give me some slack. And he was reassuring them. And with you know, him patting them on the head, they backed off and just never got back to it. He was also doing the same thing about the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, which was being investigated in that cycle. And also the Chilean operation, the killing of, you know, the track one, track two, ouster and killing of Salvador Allende in Chile. And he was fending off an investigation of that. In the FBI stuff, the Justice Department was investigating some of the mercenaries who had been involved in the CIA's Angola program. And they were asking us specifically which ones had worked for us and in what capacity. And a young attorney showed up from the general counsel's office responding to Bush's supervision policies and actually went through my files and purged documents that he thought would be legally incriminating if we were subpoenaed, you know, if we were investigated. And all of that was a thorough indication of Bush's policies as I witnessed them. Beyond that, we have an incredible record that we'll get into in greater depth as we chat here now of the connections that he picked up when he was CIA director. So we have not only Noriega, but we have a dozen or dozens of Noriegas who have blackmail control of this man. Now, one would like to give anyone the benefit of the doubt and say, hopefully they're going to be more moderate. But this man even wished he to be more moderate on CIA activities would have an uphill fight, because that establishment has got so much dirt on him. And I personally don't believe he really has any desire or instincts to withdraw from them. I think he sees a secret world that goes back to that skull and bones thing at Yale, that kind of secret elite manipulation, the Knights of Malta. I think I think psychologically he's just deeply committed to a view of the world where there's elite insiders who are well above the normal laws of man and God.
You look at see who's been the heads of the CIA all these years, and it's been people who've been right up at the top and intermingled, interlocked with the top people in the American power structure. It seems that that's such an important part, running an intelligence service, that the establishment people don't want any outsiders doing it.
Well, what is the implication then of having an ex-CIA director, the President of the United States? This is the first time that this has ever happened, that someone who is so deeply involved in intelligence activities is actually the president.
Well, it's a giant step towards the national security state, is what it is. It's a huge victory for the national security establishment. And always remember that although it goes far beyond the CIA, but the CIA was created in the National Security Act of 1947. And the National Security Establishment has the CIA as the, sort of one of the inner chapters, so to speak. And to have one of its directors bought into the thing totally and controlled by all of the illegal activities that he's been privy to and part of, it means just that. We've been watching and worrying, and people have been writing books for 15 years about the national security state. And this is a giant step in that direction, is what it amounts to.
So does that mean that the CIA will have much more influence in current policy than they would have otherwise? And that Bush has this mentality, the sort of conspiratorial, covert action, interventionist view of the world that these people have. How do you think that might translate practically into a increased role for the CIA? Or increased influence on Bush?
You get into some nuances or personalities, if you will. Yeah. Overall, the establishment that the CIA represents is much stronger, having Bush as president. However, it's difficult to imagine the CIA being more dominant and active than it was under William Casey, for the simple reason that the man was wild, as Wild Bill Casey.
Right.
And he was running poorly thought out, very aggressive operations in every corner of the world. Now, Bush has decided to go with William Webster. Now, Webster is no saint.
As the head of the CIA.
As the head of the CIA, which means...
Right.
Yes, which means the head of the intelligence community, because the CIA director coordinates all of the intelligence
right.
in the seven bureaucracies. Webster is no saint. It's not that that it makes you feel reassured. In fact, he ran COINTELPRO 2 in the FBI under Reagan when they were harassing the people who were supporting the lobbying against the Contras. And what's the most ominous thing about this man is that the establishment exonerated him totally. He was permitted by the Congress, by the establishment, by the Washington Post media, at the end of that thing, when it was exposed, of taking the idiots out, the stupidity out, the moron out, of saying, well, it's true I was director of the FBI, but I wasn't aware of any of these activities. And, the admiral's ship sinks, and he said, well, I wasn't aware it had a hole in the side.
It sounds like the Ronald Reagan deficient management style, or simply lying.
And Bush used the same out. He sat in 17 meetings of the National Security Council in which they discussed the Iran-Contra scandal And he says he doesn't remember their ever having talked about it.
There was also another interesting thing that he said when they asked him about Oliver North on one of the TV things. He said, well, they made two or three mistakes. The fact that it was all illegal never fazed him. It didn't make any difference.
Back to Webster, though, it's interesting to note that two levels of the intelligence or national security establishment, not the community, the paid professionals, the on-duty professionals, but the community has spoken out at two levels. One, at the Henry Kissinger level, they've gotten together and published a paper in which they have spelled out policies that Bush should follow, which speak pretty openly of brutality towards the Third World.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a level below that, the Georgetown professors, where McFarlane went to work after he left the White House, where Ray Klein and others operate from, where they publish these books, the intelligence requirements for the 80s, and now they've come out for the 90s. Robert Gates, the former deputy director, these people have come out with publications and statements and radio interviews and whatnot, vigorously protesting Webster as CIA director because they say he is soft on covert action. He's not aggressive enough.
Yet we know that Bush is such a believer in covert action that at least it's unlikely there'll be that much of a curtailing of covert action.
Well, we're getting into nuances. They're going to run operations for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of how many and how wild. And then at a certain point, you see, it's almost in the world's interest. God knows this is a perverse kind of logic, but it's almost in the world's interest to have a William Casey as opposed to William Webster. Because Casey would go so far that he would self-destruct.
Right.
He was truly crazy, wild. And so these things would be exposed,
right.
And there would be a reaction. The Congress would clash with him
right.
endlessly. He would mining the harbors and lie about it. Whereas Webster is muting it with the Congress and building good relations. And by having a little bit better judgment, he may actually accomplish more in the long run, and it may be harder for us to crack it open.
Okay, Morris, in our second half of this broadcast, we're going to be dealing with the Groom Lake in Area 51. But I want to say, before we get down into any more of this broadcast, we want to say that all of you guys are on your social sites, if you're on Facebook or Twitter or what have you, send me a friend request and so that I can grant that. We place a lot of information over here on Facebook for you so you can come in. Get a hold of some documents and get some very, very informative information that's posted there for your education. Just go over to send that friend request to Tahaka Amana L. Bay. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A. And Amana is A-M-A-A-N-A and then L. Bay. Send that to me. I'll grant that friend request. That'll give you access to our groups as well as the information that we post on the walls for your educational purpose. We're at that Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, MySpace, and all these different places. So I'll go ahead and send that friend request, okay?
Now, I also mentioned, too, that a fellow that has been in touch with me for an awful long time, his brother was in the CIA, or is in the CIA. He will never talk about the CIA to him. He will never give anything away whatsoever, except one bit of advice. He said, never watch the television. Never watch the television. It's the greatest scientific indoctrination tool ever devised. Haven't you figured that out? It's changed the whole culture of nations, not just one nation. Why do you think it was mandatory that everybody in Britain give access to televisions by the government? Why do you think China is under the same program to get everyone with a TV right now? Because they love to have you entertained. Do you really think that? And India is on the same route as well right now too. Most of your ideas and your opinions and how you emulate, because you emulate things, you mimic what you see, as Charles Galton, Darwin and others had said in the past. It becomes you, you become it. And that's what's happened. It's been very, very, very successful. Never watch the television. You can't watch a movie unless you do it critically, if you watch it critically. Not there to enjoy it. Remember what they say, it's your emotions that get you on. And it's interwoven, all these emotional themes all through movies. You're played like a harp. And they embed ideas into you, along with the movies. And predictive programming too, so you'll accept that which is still to come. And you'll behave the same way as the characters in the movie when it comes. Oh well, what can you do? I'll just watch much music or television. Yeah. You're given a mind of your own, and you've got to use it for yourself. And believe you me, if you ever had a nation or wanted a nation, you'd have to make sure that everyone took their turn. Everyone took their turn. Just like jury duty, to go in and oversee the guys that are supposed to be taking care of everything on your behalf. It's a tight club right now. It's been like that forever, because they never intended to give you anything called democracy, or, in fact, a republic. Gangs and fraternities run the systems of the countries. That's how they're run. And under taxation, and it's true what Marx said, and it's true what Lenin said, but that part of it, all wealth comes from labor. And tax is another term for labor. When they take your labor from you and give you nothing back for it, that's called stealing and slavery. Slavery, folks. But no teacher told you that, did they? Look at the dictionaries, you can find an old enough one, because they keep changing them too. From Hamish, myself, from Ontario, Canada, it's good night to me, your God, or your gods go with you.
I attempted to, a lot of black people in America, and a lot of black people that didn't just kind of join the club, so to speak, and just kind of go along with what anything that the Obama administration kind of put out, simply because there was this overall feeling about Obama in the black neighborhood as though he's the second coming of Jesus Christ. And we know that's not true. So whether it's Obamacare, gun control, abortion, the bailouts, or whatever it was pertaining to, a lot of people just went along with it without looking into it. And I think that's the first mistake that we make, simply because we need to look at the agenda as opposed to the individual. There's a beautiful picture that depicts the bird of freedom, the eagle, which represents America, flying high and soaring over all the other lands and governments and systems that are set up. Why do they use the phoenix, or why do they use the eagle? Simply because the eagle flies the highest. That particular science was stolen from ancient Kemet, but nonetheless, the Democrat and Republican Party are two wings of the same damn bird. So when we get into this particular discussion about Democrats wanting this and controlling that, and Republicans not agreeing to this and controlling the House and this kind of thing, we have to understand something, that it's the same people that control both parties. So when we talk about the Hegelian dialectic principle, of course you have the Reds, the Republican Party, and the Blues, which is the Democratic Party, and no one even talks above a whisper when it talks about interjecting and creating a third party which can balance out the two. Both of those particular parties are controlled by the same people. And if you do not understand anything about this particular talk today, understand that the same people control both parties. And we need to understand that from this point moving forward. So when you talk about false flags, you're talking about them creating incidents, as we've seen recently in Boston, which we can't expound on, which we've seen in London, which we've seen in New York and other places on the globe, where they want you to think that these particular things are going on so they can push a certain bill, or they can push, they can take away certain rights from the people. And I think a lot of times these bills are signed based on hype, hysteria, mass hysteria, created and put out there and fostered by the same people that are trying to take the rights away. So when you're talking about an incident going down, we have to look not only at the incident, but what's going on behind the incident and what bill are they trying to pass, what particular law that they're trying to sign in, and then what rights are at stake that they're taking and continue to take from the American people.
Well, you know something, I think a lot of people have called me and asked me about sovereignty, and the way I understand it, I only kind of answer that question as it relates to the whole 30 to 60 million of us becoming a sovereign country within inside of America, unless some African government can cough up some land. You understand what I'm saying? You as an individual becoming sovereign and fighting these people downtown and filing some paperwork with the same people that got you in this situation in the first place is ridiculous. Ask the Native American how many times he filed some paperwork downtown with the treaties that he signed with these people. It ain't gonna happen. If they were already living on land that they owned, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened? I thought they were already sovereign. I'm talking about the treaties that the Native Americans, all of the 200 tribes, the treaties that they signed with this government, were they respected?
Of course not.
Okay, and what makes you think yours is going to be respected downtown?
Obama's not setting aside a certain particular set aside for black people in reference to Obamacare. It's going to affect all of us. And some of the same ones with the lip service are the same ones that claim themselves to be good red-blooded Americans. And this particular, this thing is sad. So what I did for you, specifically for you, is I pulled up all of the things that Barack Obama promised that he never kept. And this is not a document coming from Professor Griff. We'll talk about who it comes from in a minute. Did Barack H. Obama deliver on his promises? Broken promise number one, sunlight before signing, which we talked about earlier. When Obama campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in Manchester, New Hampshire, on June 22, 2007, he announced his sunlight before signing promise. When there is a bill that ends up on my desk as the president, you, the public, will have 5 days to look online and find out what's in it before I sign it, he said. Now, let's look into some of the bills that he has passed. Did you, as red-blooded Americans, get to look at NDAA? Come on, man. I'm laughing inside while I'm saying this because you sound like a hypocritical idiot. You want to come at Professor Griff. All right, you want to blast Alex Jones and other people. You want to confront the info warriors and the infomaniacs. But we know what we talk about because we have documented proof. That's the first promise that he broke. So you talk to me about stop and frisk and what that madness is about. Talk to me about Homeland Security. Talk to me about the TSA and what's going to go down at all of the airports. Talk to me. Anyway, too often bills are rushed through Congress and to the president before the public has the opportunity to review them. As president, Obama will not sign any non-emergency bill without giving the American public an opportunity to review and comment on the White House website for 5 days. What 5 days did I get to look at NDAA? Come on, talk to me. I don't hear nobody talking. But anyway, broken promise number two, capital gain tax elimination. According to the comprehensive tax plan released during his campaign, Obama promised to eliminate capital gains taxes for small businesses. I have a small business, which is taxed to the hilt. You have small businesses that we can barely keep simply because multinational corporations are given set asides and tax-free this and tax-free that and loopholes in the way out. Not you, the small businessman. So when we talk about gun control and controlling guns, and then we mention Walmart, and Walmart is brought into the conversations, all of a sudden we have to talk about these set asides and someone that's there on the Hill representing Walmart. Who is on the Hill talking and speaking for you, the small businessman and woman? Nobody. Broken promise number 3, new American job tax credit. Come on, need I talk about that? I can't afford to be taxed $3,000 a year as a small businessman. I'm the one that needs to set aside in the loopholes. I'm the one that needs someone on the Hill speaking in reference in my behalf. You understand what I'm saying? If a company that currently has 10 U.S. employees increases its domestic full-time employment to 20 employees, this company would get a $3,000 tax credit. Well, I can't afford 20 employees. Obama's promise was never included in the stimulus package. Broken promise number 4, hiatus on the 401k penalties. Many unemployed and financially strapped Americans have considered early withdrawals on 401k and retirement accounts to survive the current recession. You see how you're being squeezed? You're being wrung the f*** out and hung to dry because you're having to tap in to the savings that you've saved all your life and the hard work that you've put in working from sun up to sundown. Can't see morning to can't see evening. You go to work, it's dark. You come home from work, it's dark. You're working to the bone, man. To now having to tap into your 401k and your retirement and your savings just to survive the recession? Come on, man. All of the broken promises, man. I don't want to go out on a date with America and you promising something at the end of the night that you know I'm not going to get, stroking my ego and stroking a few other things. Are you following me? If you're not going to come across and you're not going to come through, then don't make me the promise. And he's promised a whole lot of things to Black America. And I'm telling you, man, go take these damn cameras to the hood and interview the average Black person on the street about Barack Obama. And they'll say Barack Obama's made a whole bunch of promises that he's not going to keep. You got some of that yesterday when we was in the car. I was getting unscrupulous phone calls from men and women. And they said they don't buy into the Barack Obama hype. Pitch. Don't believe the hype. Anyway, broken promise number 5. No jobs for the lobbyists. All these people that get together and create these lobbies, and they go and they put their monies and their resources and their energy behind a particular candidate and a particular bill, these people have invested interests. Why are they the ones getting the jobs? You don't have the job. The little piece of job that you got to string together, two or three part-time jobs that you have to work to string together a meager existence in America, please, man. Please, where's Barack Obama taking us? Straight to hell. And you're going to be on the way to hell, you're going to be hungry going there because you don't have enough money in reference to your paycheck to put together enough money to feed your family. Let me tell you something. There's more Black people in America than there are some countries. So what's wrong with us being just sovereign? Do we have to take the responsibility of carving out our own destiny? Then and only then, I think, will this government respect us. Do you remember the Occupy movement? We was preparing food and coming up with a way to put together certain monies so certain businesses can, without naming them, would donate food so we could put together InfoWarriors to go out and InfoManiacs to go out to take the food to the Occupy movement. Even though I'm not really 1,000% behind that, you holding up a placard and you're speaking and yelling at empty buildings, okay, fine, but if that's your way of protest, do your thing. But did I give my efforts behind it to help orchestrate some people to come and take money and get monies and food from businesses that do support you in private, but they can't, you know, do it in public to feed you? Yeah, of course I did. Because I may not be the one on the front line in reference to occupying a certain city, but nonetheless, I applaud your effort. But my point is this. Some of the occupiers were out there hungry. They don't have jobs. Hell, occupying 24/7 or 8-hour shift, they didn't get paid for that. We need to understand this is very, very real. Earmark reform. Hell, we could talk about that all day. Broken promise number 7, bring troops home in 16 months. What month is this? And they're just now talking about bringing them home. Although we're hearing the little rumbling of bags being packed in Afghanistan, nonetheless, you know, the average Latino brother, Native American, the average black brother, the poor white, I don't see them coming home. No time soon. No time soon. However, in February 27, Obama declared, let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end. Thank you. Precisely. See, silence is golden. You understand what I'm saying? As we close, broken promise number 9, $4,000 college credit. Who got that? Tay Tay Riri.
Okay, well, what's the solution to the mortgage fraud? It's very, very simple. There's documentation whereby you can cancel a mortgage and property taxes at the same time. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. If you are not in foreclosure, however, you have been served with some notices about your mortgage, being late, if you just don't have the money, cancel the contract. It's real, real simple. Along with your get rid of the mortgage package, we'll also give you Tahaka's archives. That way you cannot go wrong. Feel free to contact me, Tahaka Monreal Bay, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay, Morris.
Man, and Twan and them that's struggling, begging for money for their parents every month, quarterly, they never got that. $4,000 on a card, a debit card that will run out at the end of $4,000 to a college student is like heaven. You mean to tell me I get a chance to eat today? A college student would be in heaven, man. Obama pledged to make college affordable for all Americans. Isn't that what Muammar Gaddafi did? Free education, free health care. Well, we don't even get that under the Obama administration. But you murder and assassinate Muammar Gaddafi, who provided that for every citizen in Libya. Barack Obama pledged to make college affordable for all Americans when announced his American Opportunity Tax Credit. His campaign promise read, the universal and fully refundable credit will ensure that the first $4,000 of a college education is completely free for most Americans and will cover two-thirds of the cost of tuition for the average public college and university and make community college tuition completely free for most students. Recipients of the credit will be required to conduct 100 hours of community service. Is that a deal or is that a shakedown? So as long as you put in 100 community hours of community service, all right, and you're a citizen, and we can check you off on the list, and you meet the requirements, then and only then will you get the $4,000 credit. Broken promise number 10, transparency. Can I close my iPad on that one? Government is not transparent, man. There's so many wicked things going on in the government that, hell, we can't even tell you. And this is a damn documentary film. So I have in front of me a document by Wayne Madsen, and it talks about the manufacturing of a president, the CIA's insertion of Barack H. Obama Jr. into the White House. From that particular document, I started looking behind this particular document at all the president's men. I looked into the birth certificate. I looked into Barack Obama Sr. I looked into his involvement with being maneuvered and controlled by the CIA. We looked into his mom, the bloodline, the lineage. We could talk about all of that. But we want to talk about all of the president's men, and I want to talk about three men that I mentioned in my book, The Psychological Covert War on Hip-Hop, The Illuminati's Takeover of Hip-Hop. In the 10th chapter, I talked about Common, who was invited to the White House. I talked about Ludacris, who wrote a song for Barack Obama, who was invited to the White House. I talked about Jay-Z, who signed off on gay marriage and endorsed it, who was invited to the White House. I talked about Will.i.am, who wrote a song, Yes We Can, who was invited to the White House. And we all know Yes We Can backwards is Thank You Satan. We could talk about a few other people that was invited to the White House. But why is hip-hop in bed with Barack Obama, who is in bed with the global elite, who is in bed with the banksters, who is in bed with the neocons? We have to understand this particular dynamic. So it runs deep.
It affects art and culture, entertainment. Although you just think it's an opportunity to be in the White House because it looks good on your discography, you don't even understand what you're doing and who you are aligning yourself with and what agenda and that you're carrying out unknowingly. So when we talk about the Illuminati takeover of hip-hop, and we talk about Jay-Z, and a lot of people say, well, Jay-Z is the Illuminati. Well, no, he's not. He's carrying out the Luciferian demonic agenda of the Illuminati. And then we say, well, what's Barack Obama's affiliation and association with the Illuminists and the Illuminati? You have to understand something. These same people may control AOL, Yahoo, Google. So we have to look beyond and past a Google search. We have to cross-reference. We have to connect the dots. We have to go out on the street and get and have conversations with the average person. So let's look at all of the president's men. Those are just a few of them dealing with arts, culture, and entertainment, dealing with the Illuminati. Let's look at a few other ones. Adolfo Nicholas, who is the 30th Superior General, Society of Jesus, which they affectionately call him the Black Pope. No, not the Black Pope, but the Black Pope. Not the one that they come to the Vatican and kiss the ring. The one that's really running things, the Black Pope. Not the one that they parade in front of you. We're talking about the Black Pope. Go do your research. George Soros, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, member of the Carlyle Group, multi-billionaire, major stockholder in Halliburton, Hungarian ancestry, socialist communist financial backer of Barack H. Obama, friend of Rupert Murdoch. All right? We need to understand these particular people and who they are and what role do they play in installing a president into the White House. Rupert Murdoch, a member of Council on Foreign Relations, a member of the Knights of St. Gregory, an international media mogul, owner of Fox News, friend of George Soros. A cult, listen now, here's the line. I don't want you just to get past you or by you. An occult protector of Barack Hussein Obama. You didn't hear what I said. The term occult is not that bad. Occult simply means hidden. But when it comes to these people, they speak a language far beyond your comprehension because they talk in terms of black and white magic. And they talk, you use occultic, linguistic kind of terms that you may not be privy to or you may not understand. For example, George Bush II, Jr., when he spoke for 8 years, you barely understood anything George Bush Jr. said because he stumbled through his words. But the phrases and the phraseology and the way he pronounced certain words, putting certain phrases along with other phrases, it's called doublespeak. The term is called doublespeak. And you can do the research. Dig up Stephen Jacobson, Mind Control in America, Backwards Masking and Doublespeak. George Bush Jr. was good at this. So you could be listening to a speech, and you could scratch your head at the end of 30 minutes or 90 minutes. You say, what the hell did he talk about? But he got his message over to the people that he was speaking to because he wasn't speaking to you. Joseph R. Biden. Who the f*** is this character? And where did they drag this character out of the woodworks? From Delaware. We don't even go to Delaware. Stop lying. You don't go to Delaware. You go right past Delaware on your way to Philly, right or wrong. You don't even, there's nothing to stop in Delaware about or for. The credit card companies are there in Delaware, right or wrong. DuPont and some of the other multinational corporations, you don't even stop in Delaware. You don't know one in Delaware. So they dragged this character out of Delaware. I never heard of this character. But Joseph R. Biden, a papal knight, Jesuit temporal, his words I can't even pronounce, because he belongs to this elite club,
that are controlled by the Jesuits. And we need to understand that this is one of the ones that are sitting next to Barack Obama to make sure Barack Obama carries out the agenda. The damn vice president? The vice president of what? The presidency is a corporation, man. And we need to understand that Barack Obama sits as the president of a corporation, which are controlled by corporations. Joe Biden just sits as vice president of that same corporation. Promoter of the Council on Foreign Relations. His honorary degrees of the Jesuit, from the Jesuit University of Scranton in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's another ungodly place. You been to Scranton? Thank you. Precisely my point. Precisely my point. You have no clue who the f*** even lives in Scranton. What the f*** do they do there? Anyway, now, this may resonate with hip-hop artists, and I don't know if you can see this. Are they big pimping, or are they just popping collars? So we need to understand these particular dynamics. And who are these people that Barack Obama has to go and kiss the ring and answer to? So when it talks about issues that affect the American people, I don't care if it's preparedness. I don't care if it's stocking up food. Barack Obama is controlled, bought, and paid for. So when you talk about gun control, the question here is it about guns or is it about control? We need to understand that. So those are some of the president's men. Now, if we could just kind of have a fireside chat about some other things, we can kind of dive into some of these things that Barack Obama has to say and do to keep the agenda and the machine fueled, well-oiled. And we need to understand it because we already talked about the media. We talked about the corporations. We talked about all the president's men. We talked about Barack Obama's agenda and his influence dealing with hip-hop artists to deal with arts and culture because I'm telling you, the masses of the people that have voted for Barack Obama was groomed well via MTV, BET, and some of the multinational corporations that influence entertainment, arts, and culture. And don't you ever damn think that MTV, VH1, and all of the other alphabet boys are not in cahoots and in bed with Barack Obama and those that control the media to carry out the agenda. That's how they carry out the agenda. From unsuspecting masses of the people who carry out the agenda unknowingly. We need to understand that.
I know half a dozen people right now languishing in prison behind this sovereignty stuff. A friend of mine told me yesterday while we was walking, he said it's probably some dudes up in prison with a whole bunch of time on their hands figuring out this paperwork.
How do we climb out of this proverbial bag that we're in? Together. One mind, one spirit, one voice, one agenda. And if everyone is saying the exact same thing, they have no other choice. If Alex Jones is saying the same thing Professor Griff from Public Enemy is saying, you guys are saying the same thing, rappers are saying the same thing, politicians who are not afraid, who stand up and speak for what they truly believe in, if you truly believe in the Second Amendment, then they have no other choice but to say, you know something, we have to sit and listen. And then we have to have someone in those offices, in the political arenas, that can actually speak for the masses of the people, both black and white and every color in between. Do we have that? No, these sellout cowards that are there as politicians up on the Hill and in the White House, that they won't utter a word to speak for the masses of the people. So then I ask a question to you, what the f*** is democracy about? I pose a question on the internet. Does democracy work? And if it does, show me on what part of the planet it works. If democracy works, then why does America kill our leaders? So the whole idea of this war on terrorism is spreading democracy. F*** out of here. People in Libya don't want democracy? Unless the media multi-ethnic destruction in America, forces it on the people. And they want to convince you to believe that you believe that you want democracy in Libya. I'm trying to state some obvious facts that those that are watching this particular DVD, be it on YouTube, on smart ass phones, for dumb ass, we're going to put it out there and just make it very transparent, very clear, very plain, not to insult your intelligence, very elementary. And if you have a problem with the black on my face, then just mute, put a cover over the screen, just turn the volume up so you can hear what I'm saying. I don't have a problem with it. I'm sure you shouldn't. Truth is truth regardless. Are you following me? Can you imagine?
Meltdown, a four-part investigation of the orgy of greed and recklessness that drove the world into financial collapse. Only now are the hard questions being asked. Only now are the key players being held to account. In this hour, the story of the men who crashed the world. The billionaire mortgage seller who fooled millions.
Everybody wanted to own a piece of real estate to get into the game.
The high-rolling banker with a fatal weakness.
Jimmy Cain tried to handle what looked like a joint. I'm not kidding.
The ferocious Wall Street predator.
I want to reach in, rip out their heart, and eat it before they die.
And the power behind the throne.
The de facto president of the United States was an unelected gentleman from Wall Street.
Meltdown, the secret history of the global financial collapse. The crash of September 2008 brought the largest bankruptcies in world history, pushed over 30 million people into unemployment, and brought many countries to the edge of insolvency. Wall Street turned back the clock to 1929. After the Wall Street crash of 29, which led to the Great Depression, the U.S. Congress launched an official investigation.
Interest in the senatorial bank investigation as J.P. Morgan arrives to testify.
J.P. Morgan was among the business titans to be called to account by the Pecora Commission. Flash photography was introduced to heighten the spectacle. In 2010, the same model is followed for a new investigation of a new financial collapse.
Panel, ladies, photographers, move aside.
Former California Treasurer Phil Angelides is chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
I'm honored to welcome you as we start this series of public hearings into the causes of the financial and economic crisis.
He has taken sworn testimony from a parade of government and bank officials, trying to get to the bottom of what really caused the 2008 meltdown.
The consequences of this financial crisis have been grim also. 27 million Americans who are either out of work, can't find full-time work, or stop looking for work. Millions who have lost their homes, and millions more who are in the foreclosure process. Trillions of dollars of wealth loss. I think one of our jobs is to try to rationally explain to people what the heck happened. People want to know.
How did it all go so wrong? The key trigger of the 2008 financial meltdown was easy lending in the U.S. housing market. In an era of very low interest rates and reduced bank regulation, there was an astonishing building boom across the United States. In California, banks decided that virtually anyone could qualify for a home loan. Jim Kling has been a real estate agent in San Diego for over 20 years.
Really, in 2004 and 2005, if you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan. That's how bad it was. they didn't really know or care about the qualifications of the buyers. And whether those people could make those payments or not apparently wasn't much of a concern.
Bills getting to be more than you can manage? Crossroads Mortgage has a whole range of solutions geared to people just like you.
So if you're thinking of buying a home or refinancing?
Even if your credit is less than perfect, AmeriQuest can help. Call 1-800-
Banks began making what were called subprime loans to people who could ill afford to pay back the money, especially if house prices ever went down. The one man who could have stopped that practice was then U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. For 20 years, the world's most powerful banker. Greenspan was revered in Washington. His power feared even by presidents.
The Federal Reserve was the one agency that had the full authority to regulate subprime lending. And despite all the evidence, despite all the yellow and red lights going off, they chose not to.
Staff reports. I mean, would you, let me just ask you, would you put this under the category of oops? Should have done it?
I mean, my experience has been, in the business I was in, I was right 70% of the time, but I was wrong 30% of the time. And there are an awful lot of mistakes in 21 years.
And I would point out that the captain of the Titanic was 99% right and 1% wrong. It's the size of the mistake that matters.
We now know that banks and mortgage companies were indulging in all sorts of fraudulent practices to pump up their mortgage business. Many of the loans were extremely complex and the terms hidden from borrowers. There were low teaser rates that would automatically reset to much higher payments after a few months. It was no accident that the most complex mortgages were sold to the least sophisticated buyers, especially in poor and minority neighborhoods like this one in South Central Los Angeles.
So as you go about your daily work and your daily business...
Congresswoman Maxine Waters has represented the district for 19 years in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Good information.
You know, I've seen mortgages that were given to 70-year-old people who were on a fixed income, whose income was never going to increase, but that mortgage was going to reset within a few years. Where was that money going to come from? I've seen mortgages that I think are criminal.
Angelo Mozzillo was the undisputed king of the U.S. subprime market. He is called the Golden Boy because of his permanent tan and because at the height of the subprime real estate boom, he was making about $100 million a year.
Everybody wanted to own a piece of real estate to get into the game.
He became the darling of business magazines with a slew of fawning profiles of his rags-to-riches story. He always claimed that he was a friend to the poor and that his lending practices were helping scores of Americans attain the dream of home ownership.
It's one thing for him to say that he was a friend to the poor, but in the final analysis, when you see that these poor people are now in foreclosure, now cannot get loan modifications, now ending up on the streets, then certainly that defies how he could have been, you know, a friend to poor people.
Mozzillo's company, Countrywide Financial, grew to become the biggest mortgage lender in the United States.
Call Countrywide. We never stop thinking about what you need. And that makes home buying easy. Really.
Countrywide was sold to Bank of America and almost immediately plunged in value. Angela Mozzillo was placed under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC uncovered very damaging private emails in which Mozzillo expressed his true feelings about the dangerous subprime mortgages he was peddling. He wrote, "In all my years in the business, I have never seen a more toxic product." At the same time, Mozzillo was publicly reassuring all his investors and clients. Countrywide views the product as a sound investment for our bank and a sound financial management tool for consumers.
It does appear that there was a private view of the markets, and there was one that was espoused to borrowers, rating agencies, the investing public.
The SEC has now charged Mozzillo with insider trading and securities fraud.
Lenders like Angela Mozzillo really didn't care if people ever paid their mortgages because those loans did not stay on the mortgage company's books. Mortgages were bundled together with other loans from across the country and moved to Wall Street. There, they were packaged up into complex new financial products. Bankers went wild for these financial securities that were really just stacks of IOUs. There was almost no government regulation of this market. It became a massive system of buying and selling these IOUs, with fees being charged on each transaction.
It was just all a way to make fees and to package up these streams of supposed cash flows and sell them off to investors. I mean, for a while there, anybody who touched a mortgage made money. It was like the most perfect product.
I once had this view that when people start talking about toxic assets, but somehow they were like a good piece of fruit that had turned bad. Well, it turns out they were a rotten piece of fruit from day one. And all along the way, whether it was the broker, the lender, the securitizer, the market maker, everyone seems to have taken the view that they had no responsibility for the product that they were moving along in the system.
That became, unfortunately, this cancerous material that was injected into financial institutions all over the world.
One of the first places these toxic products landed was the financial district of London, England, nicknamed the City. There was a golden age here in the years before the meltdown. Garrett Anderson arrived in the City as a young trader in 1996. He had been a hippie selling trinkets on the beaches of India until his older brother found him a job in a London brokerage.
I literally didn't know what the City was. I mean, I kind of was aware that there was a stock market, and I said, well, why? I mean, you have to wear a suit and things like that. And he said, I'll tell you why. It's quite simple. You'll have about £300,000-£400,000 within about 4 or 5 years, and then you can go off and live the life you want to live. Since the selling of trinkets wasn't going down too well, I thought, why not? I had no idea about finance whatsoever. I didn't know what a P/E ratio was. I didn't know what a yield was. When you're in the City, all you have to do continually is present a view and present it strongly and pretend you believe in it. It was all about schmoozing clients, taking them to strip joints, taking them to bars, getting that company credit card out and really giving it a bash.
The wild atmosphere in Britain was brought about because Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown was easing financial regulation there. He called his new approach the light touch.
We will advance if there is light touch regulation, a competitive tax environment, and flexible.
Well, Gordon Brown light touch was an effort really to make the City of London the world's greatest financial centre. And it meant giving the financiers, giving the bankers a very free hand in the marketplace.
Paul Martin was Canada's finance minister in those years. He says deregulation came about because of a competition between New York and London to become the financial capital of the world.
The race to become number one was very, very important. But how do you attract the financial industry? Well, the most logical way is what they call regulatory arbitrage, which simply says, let's gut the regulatory system, and therefore more people will come.
The prevailing culture was one that the markets always go up. It was an easy way to make money, drinking champagne, fat cat analysts. It was a joyous time. Everywhere you looked, there was great big new offices being put up, statues being put in the forecourts, people building great monuments to themselves in terms of the buildings they occupied and the way that they behaved.
By 2004, Garrett Anderson was making a salary of $300,000 a year, plus an annual bonus of $700,000. He was invited onto business television shows as an analyst.
Strong. We had profit before tax growth of 9.5%. The whole game is increasing your bonus. You don't go into the City to do the world some good. You go there to make money as quickly as possible. And if that means lying, cheating and stealing, that's what you do. Regulators and politicians are just deemed to be idiots. It's all about, we will thrive with light touch regulation. And that, of course, is exactly what Gordon Brown was encouraging as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And interestingly, he calls my precise period in the City the age of irresponsibility. it was partly to do with the fact he just said anything goes. And, you know, to me it's just obvious. The way people were behaving was a rational way of behaving in the context of the bonus system and the lack of regulation.
If one country could be the microcosm of everything that went wrong in the years before the meltdown, Iceland is it. It is a place of staggering natural beauty. From its geysers, to its waterfalls, to its famous Blue Lagoon, it is a magnet for tourists. One thing Iceland was never known for was banking and high finance, at least until a few years ago. Iceland was transformed through the ideas of one man, longtime Prime Minister David Oddsson. He decided to shake Iceland out of its social democratic past and remake the country according to his free market principles. He surrounded himself with like-minded admirers.
David Oddsson is somebody who fulfills the two criteria that Machiavelli puts up about political leaders. He is cunning as a fox and he's courageous as a lion.
David Oddsson wanted to privatize almost everything touched by government. Iceland's number one resource industry has always been fishing. Oddsson parceled up the country's fishing grounds and passed them off to big ship owners. On Egil Helgason's popular political TV show, the reaction was disbelief.
For many people, this would sound as it's almost surreal. You take the fishing grounds, the fish that swims in the sea, and you give it to a bunch of people who own ships for good. This is the main resource of our country. This was the beginning of what came later.
In 2003, Oddsson made his most controversial privatization. Some of the biggest banks in the country were auctioned off in suspicious circumstances. Coincidentally, they ended up in the hands of some of David Oddsson's closest friends.
Mr. Oddsson's friends were father and son who came from Russia with some money they had made from shady dealings in the brewery business in St. Petersburg. And suddenly they found themselves to be the owners of the oldest bank in Iceland. These guys didn't know the first thing about banking. In retrospect, they're either greedy criminals or complete fools.
The newly privatized Icelandic banks embarked on an orgy of dangerous financial practices. Bankers sold securities back and forth to each other at vast markups that falsely inflated their value. All Icelanders were encouraged to buy a house, or even two. The central bank lowered interest rates, flooding the country with easy credit. As in the United States, this triggered an unprecedented real estate boom. Icelanders living and working abroad came home to take advantage of the wild market.
I lived in the UK till 2003, 2004. Then I came home. I bought a flat for 9 million kroner here downtown, almost close to where we are now. 1.5 years later, I sell it for almost 15 million kroner. I'm like, hey, what's going on? I've done nothing to this flat. And here we are, 6 million kroner in my pocket, just for keeping it for 1.5 years. And of course, when you're benefiting from it, you're sort of, okay, well, this is great. There's a saying now, if something is extravagant, oh, this is so 2007, you can't be serious. 2007 is having Elton John in your 50th birthday party, as one of the business tycoons did. People just went too far. People took one loan too many. People bought one car too many.
Iceland was not alone in its reckless financial planning during the boom years. The world champion of the global real estate bubble was surely Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Money was no object, as every local sheikh and every booming company competed to see who could erect the most ostentatious building. No idea was considered too outlandish. When waterfront property rose dramatically in value, Dubai decided to make more. Ships vacuumed sand off the ocean floor to make the famous Palm Islands.
On them were built an endless line of luxury condominiums and hotels that were snapped up by wealthy investors from across Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. Canadian Robert Lee went to work for Dubai's leading real estate company 10 years ago.
Dubai in its heydays, we used to call the sales center the fish market. People could come and would say, give me an apartment, any apartment, I don't care what, two bedrooms, three bedrooms, just give me an apartment. Because in a way, people are buying options, because most people were buying things with zero intention of actually living in it. So they were buying coupons to resell it to somebody else. We'd be selling $1 billion worth of real estate in one day.
All of this flowed from the vision of one man, Dubai ruler Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. When he saw the first plans for what would become the world's tallest building, the Burj Khalifa, he had only one comment to the developer: make it bigger.
I was silly to suggest a 90-story building, and the meeting was very short. He just left. But you know, I've been with him a long time, so I went again to the design studios, and then we put something really marvelous, and his question was, how much higher than anybody else? I said, about 40% plus. He said, great. He called me the next day and he said, where are the cranes?
Was there no limit to how high Dubai could fly before it got too close to the sun?
There was always a nagging sensation that, is Dubai going to be like the other cities around the world that has seen the fall? But at the same time, you live here for a few years, you basically buy the story. You drink the Kool-Aid. And you think, hey, we must be different.
The man who would become the central actor in the meltdown took his position on the stage in 2006. Former Goldman Sachs CEO Hank Paulson was one of the toughest of the Wall Street titans. Then he accepted the invitation of George W. Bush to become the U.S. Treasury Secretary. It was a controversial choice. Paulson was not universally loved on Wall Street.
He was probably the nastiest guy of all of them. They used to call him the snake. And this is coming from the Wall Street executives themselves. No, you know, you really can't believe everything he tells you. The reason why they didn't like him is because they couldn't trust him.
Hank Paulson's aggressive, combative style came as a bit of a shock in government circles.
He's a guy who would go through a brick wall to achieve his objective. Leopard doesn't change his spots. I mean, why do scorpions sting? They sting because that's their nature. And, you know, Hank Paulson didn't change his nature when he went to Washington.
Shortly after Hank Paulson arrived in Washington, the prices of California houses began to slide.
Sales of existing homes are down a full 12% from just a year
as ago. Prices dropped, overextended homeowners threw more properties onto the market, triggering a downward spiral.
Hank Paulson called me and started talking to me about subprime mortgages in the United States. There was a general consensus that there was too much credit and too much money sloshing around globally. We had had discussions about where this excess credit was likely to show itself, and it was showing itself in subprime mortgages in the United States, and that was a large problem.
Although few seemed to realize it, the world was now infected with the toxic financial products that depended on the U.S. real estate market. It was inevitable that someone somewhere was going to blow the whistle and question what these financial products were actually worth. As it happened, the alarm sounded in Paris in August 2007. The giant French bank BNP Paribas discovered that many of its investment funds were filled with toxic U.S. securities. They stopped all withdrawals from those funds.
It was a little bit like an old-fashioned movie where the bank president locks the door and tells people they can't get their money. it's kind of, it doesn't exactly make you feel good about the world.
At the Ministry of Economic Affairs in Paris, the BNP Paribas decision triggered immediate crisis meetings, convened by Finance Minister Christine Lagarde.
Ça a commencé de manière très dure, je m'en souviens très bien, parce que c'était interruption de vacances immédiate, retour à Paris et discussion immédiate avec les banques sur ces conduits qu'elles étaient en train de fermer en raison d'un début de fissure dans l'édifice financier.
If BNP Paribas couldn't value their securities, then one started asking how many other companies couldn't value their securities. How did anyone know what the value of asset managers were, or even banks, because of course banks were holding the same securities. And so suddenly faith in some of the foundations of 21st century finance began to crumble.
In September 2007, as cracks were appearing in the foundations of the global economy, the titans of the Anglo-American financial system began to tremble. First up was Britain's Adam Applegarth, a true superstar in London's business class. Applegarth had it all. He joined an obscure bank called Northern Rock in 1983 and had a meteoric rise, becoming CEO of the bank in 2001.
Oh, he was a brilliant fellow, full of himself, full of confidence, felt he could do no wrong, loved the idea that he was become a transatlantic jet setter. He'd go over to New York to arrange the next tranche of securitized debt, and felt he had a model which was much better than everybody else. He didn't get it. He didn't get that he'd developed an unstable model and that the wholesale markets went wrong. His bank would fall off a cliff very, very fast, which is exactly what happened.
Good evening. One of Britain's biggest mortgage lenders, Northern Rock, is applying to the Bank of England for emergency financial support. BBC News has learned that the bank...
Within hours of the BBC bulletin, worried Northern Rock customers lined up to get their money out.
Maybe it's safe, maybe it's not, but I'd rather know that it was safe. I'm just going to go and put it in my bank and
I've taken all of my money out.
Most people in the Western world had never seen a bank run before with their own eyes, and so it was something they found almost impossible to imagine.
The British government was very slow to react to the panic.
It was egg on our face as the British authorities, no doubt about that, and letting those queues not only form but continue for 2 days was very damaging to the reputation of British banking.
Adam Applegarth was hauled before a British parliamentary investigation of the failure of his bank, but he was characteristically defiant.
Mr. Applegarth, do you actually accept you've done anything wrong?
It was a good business model, but clearly couldn't deal with the unforeseen global freezing of the liquid market.
You keep saying it was unforeseen, yet this committee had been discussing it for 6 months.
The Northern Rock crisis in Britain could have been taken as a serious warning on Wall Street, but it was not.
I think people saw this as a, that's happening over there, that's not happening here. I think that the sense of interconnectedness was not realized until the very last moment.
Through the spring of 2008, U.S. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was constantly reassuring his international colleagues that everything was fine with the U.S. economy and that only mild tinkering was required with the global financial system. In private, French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde advised her friend that he was being very foolish.
Je lui ai dit, Hank, on voit le tsunami qui nous arrive dessus. Et tu es sur la plage en train d'hésiter sur la couleur du maillot de bain qu'on va porter.
The first major US casualty of the financial crisis came with the dramatic fall of one company and one man, the richest CEO on Wall Street. Jimmy Cain was a legend. He had come up through the ranks to become president and chief executive officer of America's fifth largest investment bank, Bear Stearns. He was famous for his backslapping, hard drinking, and high living style.
Jimmy is really out of central casting. I mean, I've described him as an amiable rogue. I mean, he's definitely can be quite charming, definitely can be quite ruthless, has a twinkle in his eye. And I think that combination of ruthlessness and charm, that people get to the top with that combination.
Jimmy Cain was a flashy risk taker in business and in his personal life. In 2007, he was worth over $1 billion, and he wanted everyone to know it. Every Thursday afternoon after the stock market closed, he would board a private helicopter a few blocks from his Manhattan office and fly off to his country house on the Jersey Shore for weekends of bridge and golf. He did have one troubling habit that would come back to haunt him.
He used to brag about smoking pot. I'm in the elevator of Bear Stearns, and it was 2004, 2005, and Jimmy Cain tried to hand me what looked like a joint. I'm not kidding.
Cain's pot smoking became public at the worst possible time for his firm. In the fall of 2007, Bear Stearns' risky bets on mortgage-backed securities began to go wrong. The firm started to hemorrhage money. Then in November, the Wall Street Journal carried a front-page story which portrayed Jimmy Cain as an absentee landlord who was always out of touch at either golf games or bridge tournaments while his firm was in crisis. To top it off, the Journal publicly revealed his taste for marijuana.
Joe Kernan, who's my colleague on CNBC, says, "Hey, Charlie, what do you think about that hatchet job that the Journal just did on Jimmy Cain?" And I don't know why I did this, but I started imitating smoking a joint.
Force issue, but also apparently, whole bit.
Little smoke and a little pot
say?
There.
Listen, 2 minutes later, my cell phone rings, and it's Jimmy Cain screaming at me. And he's like, "What are you doing? I don't smoke pot." I said, "Stop it. Stop it." I said, "Listen, who cares? I mean, you're not breaking the, it's kind of a harmless crime. Why don't you just laugh it off?" And I'll never forget what he said to me. He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Laugh it off. You try to laugh it off. You're not running a company."
You know, Jimmy had made a lot of enemies on Wall Street. It was a very competitive Darwinian place. If they smelled, chum in the water, the sharks are going to circle.
In January 2008, Jimmy Cain was forced out of the CEO position and became an unpaid chairman of the board at Bear Stearns, but the firm continued a downward slide. It had more exposure to toxic financial products than any other Wall Street firm. Cain had left a ticking time bomb behind him, and it exploded in March 2008. Rumors swept the financial world that Bear Stearns had liquidity problems, trouble raising cash. When Hank Paulson heard the rumors, he told his Washington staff, "This will be over within days." He knew that Bear's clients would immediately pull their cash out of the bank, causing it to collapse.
We have some breaking business news tonight. The storied investment bank Bear Stearns is reportedly close to selling it.
Paulson was right. On Sunday, March 16th, Bear Stearns was taken over by rival J.P. Morgan in a deal bankrolled by the U.S. government. Just 1 year earlier, Bear's share price had been a lofty $170.
Get this, it's valued at about $2 a share in this deal. $2 a share just last year.
People thought it was a typo. Bear stock had traded, in the 30s or 40s, closed in the previous Friday, and so, the idea that it would be worth $2 a share was impossible to fathom.
Can I ask you one question?
No.
Do you think that
in May 2010, when Jimmy Cain was summoned before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to account for the collapse of his bank, he seemed to suggest it had nothing to do with him. Cain presented Bear Stearns as a victim of market hysteria.
The market's loss of confidence, even though it was unjustified and irrational, became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
When I hear a lot of the people come before us, I'm struck by the extent to which all the fingers point away from themselves, and I'm struck by the extent to which so many people on Wall Street somehow do not draw a correlation between the actions and activities and the risks they were undertaking and the crisis that occurred.
Most world investors took exactly the wrong message from the bailout of Bear Stearns, that some banks were now considered too big to fail.
The key message that emerged after the Bear Stearns bailout was that no matter what happens, the American government, and in fact it was presumed the European government, will not let a big bank go bust.
Perhaps the most reviled figure to appear before the U.S. Congress in the aftermath of the meltdown was former Lehman Brothers CEO Richard Fuld. The 2008 collapse of his bank certainly caused the most damage to the world economy, and it financially ruined millions of Americans who had invested with Lehman.
I'm very much aware that one day we had a firm, the next day we did not.
At the hearings, Fuld became the prime target for a public that was angry at bankers. Dick Fuld had spent his entire career at Lehman Brothers, starting at the bottom and clawing his way up the ladder. In later years, he assumed all the trappings of unfettered power. His word was law, his judgment never to be questioned.
There was a huge cult of loyalty to Dick Fuld as the chief executive of the firm. People, on the one hand, admired what Dick Fuld had achieved, but secondly, this was not an organization where you, as a matter of casual incident, decided it was a good idea to disagree with Dick.
The way he created Lehman Brothers, it was almost a cult of personality. The personality was his personality, which was, it's us against them, we're going to fight everybody, and we're going to win.
Dick Fuld was determined to intimidate anyone who might cross him. In this internal Lehman UK video, he was angry that some traders were driving down his stock price.
But what I really want to do is I want to reach in, rip out their heart, and eat it before they die.
I think in the tape there's a sort of nervous laughter in the auditorium. I think that sort of reflects quite a lot about how people within Lehman saw Dick. On the one hand, it sounded at one level amusing, and then you sort of thought to yourself, I suspect if you're in that audience, the really scary thing is he sort of could probably do it.
Lehman Brothers entered its death spiral on September 11th, 2008. The stock was plummeting. Dick Fuld was advised that it was time for a fire sale of his corporate assets, but he resisted. Telephone records show that U.S. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson spoke frequently with Fuld, but he felt his message was not getting through.
He was definitely exasperated with Dick Fuld. I think everybody was. He seemed to be unable to recognize the gravity of the situation his firm was in and unable to do the things that were needed.
On Friday, September 12th, Hank Paulson decided that it was time for drastic action to save Lehman Brothers, but he did not want to authorize another government bailout. He flew to New York on his private jet and summoned all the Wall Street CEOs to an emergency meeting at the New York Federal Reserve Building.
You know, the fire alarms are going off. The tornado siren is going. And so when the chief of police and the chief of the fire department says we need the heads of all the major employers in our town to come together to come up with a plan, you come.
At 6 p.m., Hank Paulson started that secret meeting with America's leading bank CEOs. Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, John Thayne of Merrill Lynch, and John Mack of Morgan Stanley.
I began working on a plan.
Paulson told them that they all knew why they were there. Without their help, Lehman would not open for business on Monday, and the consequences for everyone sitting around that table would be disastrous. Across town, Dick Fuld was astounded that Hank Paulson had not invited him to the crisis meeting.
Here his company is basically being carved up, and he's not allowed to be there. He's calling and they're not returning his calls.
Inside Lehman Brothers, there was an air of unreality. The firm had been in existence since 1850. They had survived the Great Depression of the 1930s. They had survived the 9/11 attack that destroyed their offices in the World Trade Center. Surely they could survive this.
Tonight, one of the biggest investment firms is in serious trouble. Lehman Brothers with a
Lehman Brothers stock has been plummeting along with confidence in its ability to survive.
These people have been through it before. They were going through it again. Do you know what? The rest of the world hates us, but that's okay, because we're going to emerge on top here. And I believe that was what was persisting at Lehman Brothers right until midnight on the famous weekend. I don't think anyone really at the senior management believed it was going to happen.
On Sunday, the bankers finally came up with a private sector plan to save Lehman Brothers. The company would be divided in two. The solid assets of Lehman would be purchased by Barclays, a British bank. The American bankers agreed to take over the questionable parts of the company. Just as everyone was about to celebrate, word arrived that the British government would not approve the deal. Hank Paulson placed an emergency call to British Chancellor Alistair Darling, but couldn't budge him.
I understand Hank Paulson's problem. He had to sort out Lehman's problem, and the conversations we had were very amicable, and we understood each other's position, but I was quite clear. I could not agree to something where the British taxpayer was taking on a liability that people didn't fully understand.
Paulson hung up, feeling deflated and frustrated. He announced to everyone in the room, "The British screwed us."
Objectively, this deal was never going to happen. And the most striking thing about this whole story is how little effort the Americans gave to talking to the British authorities until literally the last minute.
Paulson knew Lehman's failure would bring financial catastrophe. Millions of people around the world would lose their savings and pensions. At this moment of maximum tension, Hank Paulson had a panic attack. He slipped out of the room and called his wife.
I just said, "Wendy, Lehman Brothers is going to fail, and it's going to be very bad, and a lot of people are looking to me, and I don't have all the answers, and I'm afraid. Would you pray for me?"
This has been an historic Sunday on Wall Street, and it's not over yet. At this hour, the Lehman Brothers Investment Bank appears headed toward bankruptcy.
With $613 billion in debt, Lehman is by far the largest bankruptcy ever in this country, dwarfing...
On the sidewalks of New York and in investment houses around the world, there was a rising sense of panic. One who felt it was Mohammed El Arian of PIMCO in California, among the world's largest institutional investors, with $1 trillion under management.
I remember calling my wife and telling her, "Go to the cash machine, take cash out, because I'm not sure whether the banks are going to open tomorrow." There was a feeling that the system was incredibly fragile, that the unthinkable was clearly thinkable.
Lehman Brothers officially declared bankruptcy at 2 a.m. There was widespread fear that could trigger a chain reaction that would take down the world banking system. At the New York Federal Reserve, then President Tim Geithner told his staff to prepare for the crash landing of Lehman. He told them to put foam on the runway.
The problem is they didn't put nearly enough foam on the runway, and there were all sorts of unintended consequences. The ripples that they anticipated turned out to be a tsunami.
The tsunami unleashed by the crash of Lehman Brothers would sweep around the globe, destroying millions of jobs and wiping out the economic future of entire countries. Protests rocked world capitals. From Reykjavik to Beijing to London.
Situation, that's kind of tricky. You cannot discharge a student loan through bankruptcy. And what we recommend is one of the most powerful set of documentations that we have in our possession. It's called the Get Rid of the Student Loan Package. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, click on the link to hawkerarchives.org, and examine the package. If you click on the little words underneath the package, the drop down box will come about. And you can do a little brief reading there, but it is specifically designed to actually cancel the contract. Along with all of the packages in TahakaArchive.org, we give you a master library. In fact, we just put a ton of information in there under Administrative Procedure Doc. We've also added new information under the Moorish American Government. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. And the information is there available for you to cancel those contracts.
Okay, Morris, we're back.
And what we're going to do now is we're going into the information concerning Area 51 and Groom Lake. We want to expose this information because there's a lot of things that's going on inside the country. There are underground cities and stuff being built, and there are people that are running for cover. A lot of these people have done all sorts of things, and they are attempting to hide and avoid the coming catastrophes and stuff. And want to make sure that you understand exactly what's going on with NASA, Area 51, and Groom Lake. I want to bring this out today, and so you can be exposed to this. For those of you who have never heard of this information, we want to bring it full circle here today.
First-hand accounts of the activities around and within the perimeter are scarce. Those few who have been inside are sworn to secrecy. But in 1989, one man came forward with an amazing claim that he had worked inside Area 51, retro-engineering an alien spacecraft.
It had an absolute classic flying saucer in there, so like something out of a cartoon or a science fiction movie. I am convinced this was an extraterrestrial craft. I verified how the equipment in it worked, and it was a technology that doesn't exist even today.
Spring 1989, Bob Lazar meets with George Knapp, a reporter for Las Vegas TV station KLAS. Lazar claims to have secrets he can no longer hold.
This was really taking a toll on me. I mean, I was exhausted.
He tells Knapp that he was hired by the federal government to work on an alien spacecraft at Area 51, and he insists that the authorities will do anything to stop him from revealing what he knows. Lazar tells the reporter he wants to protect himself from reprisals by going public with his amazing story.
Very short amount of time, and I guarantee you, gentlemen, that
Lazar's story begins in 1988 when, he says, his background in physics and electronics lands him a job interview with top government contractor Edgerton, Germershausen, and Greer, or EG&G.
I was told there was an opening available from for a new exotic field propulsion system that I would be working in a remote area. It all sounded great to me. It's exactly what I wanted to get into.
In December 1988, he is hired. On his first day of work, Lazar claims to have met a man named Dennis Mariani at the EG&G Special Projects Office at McCarran International Airport in Las Vegas.
Dennis Mariani is kind of a military-looking guy. It always looks you in the eye and very hard-looking. I don't think the guy ever smiled.
Mariani escorts Lazar aboard a private plane that flies them 100 miles north to an isolated military base in the Nevada desert, Area 51. Immediately after landing, Mariani subjects Lazar to a rigorous security briefing and has him sign a secrecy agreement.
You basically signed away a lot of your rights. I believe it was called the 10-10 agreement. It was a $10,000 fine, 10-year prison sentence, you know, for divulging any of the information presented to you.
According to Lazar, he agrees to conditions he will later regret. He even gives up his right to a trial if he ever reveals anything about working at Area 51. After Lazar signs the document, he and Mariani board a bus with blacked out windows.
The bus leaves Area 51 and drives, I'm guessing, 10 to 15 miles south on a dirt road. It was kind of exciting. I thought, boy, we're leaving Area 51 in a bus with windows that I can't look out of, this must be really secret, and so I was fascinated.
The bus finally stops at an installation called S4. Mariani explains that the site is a series of hidden hangars built into the landscape.
It's extremely well camouflaged.
Years later, Lazar will have a graphic artist create detailed renderings based on his own drawings of what he claims he saw at S4.
There are hangar doors that are sand textured, and standing back maybe 300 or 400 feet, you really can't see them at all. It pretty much just looks like a continuation of the mountain.
Mariani leads Lazar inside the tightly guarded facility.
It was very much an oppressive military atmosphere. There was always somebody there on top of you, keeping an eye on you. They were virtually robots. They had no emotions. Not to imply that they were robots, but, you know, they acted like robots.
Lazar says he has issued a security badge that authorizes his clearance through the, quote, U.S. Department of Naval Intelligence. Mariani then leads him to a secure briefing room. On the desk is a stack of blue folders.
Is everything you'll need to know to begin working on this? Until I can...
Lazar is allowed to review these files, alone.
Looking through some of the information, it gave direct references to a flying saucer, to an extraterrestrial vehicle. I pretty much discounted that and just kept going on. And I thought, well, boy, this must be part of some security measure. It could be a part of all some big psychological test of some sort. So I glanced through everything and digested what I could.
When Mariani takes him back to the hangar, Lazar claims he is confronted with an incredible sight.
We walked into a hangar, which was extremely large, and it had an absolute classic flying saucer in there. So like something out of a cartoon or a science fiction movie. It was sitting on its belly on the ground. And I went up and raised my hand to touch the metal on the craft and immediately got disciplined for that.
Lazar assumes that the vehicle is an experimental aircraft designed to resemble something from outer space.
Yeah, well, it's got a flying saucer shape. This explains why so many people see flying saucers, because we're trying to make an aircraft that way. So still nothing really hit my mind as far as being alien or anything along those lines.
But Lazar says he revises that assumption when his job duties are explained to him.
The basic aim of what we're doing here is to see if we can duplicate any of this material with substances found on Earth. Well, what do you mean with substances found on Earth? And then it began to validate some of what I had read, that this was in fact an alien craft.
As he examines the saucer, Lazar becomes convinced that it is, in fact, of extraterrestrial origin.
It was obviously made for something smaller. Ideally, about half the height of a human would have no problem walking around in there. Everything is a rounded, curved radius to it. It looks like the entire thing was an injection mold, like made out of plastic or wax.
He says he is then told that the vehicle's propulsion system allows the pilot to traverse great distances instantaneously by manipulating time and space.
If you have a machine that can create gravity, that makes force fields a reality, that makes time travel possible, all the stuff you read about in science fiction becomes possible if you can manipulate gravity.
Lazar is overwhelmed by the possibilities. Until now, he had considered the whole idea of flying saucers to be a fantasy.
It actually left me pretty much confused and led to a lot of sleepless nights for a long time.
Lazar's main responsibility is to determine what had powered the vehicle.
This was such an advanced machine that we were looking at, from the fuel to the way it was handled to the energy that it puts out. It was completely alien in every way.
He nicknames one ship the Sport Model, and claims it makes several low-altitude test flights in early 1989. Lazar says his supervisor, Dennis Mariani, invites him to observe one of them.
The craft lifted off the ground silently with a slight glow on the bottom, which I assumed was a corona discharge, kind of like a St. Elmo's fire from high voltage. Made just a little hissing sound. Lifted off the ground and moved over to the left and to the right and sat down. And to me, that was absolutely impressive.
Throughout his time at Area 51, Lazar claims, his employers keep him working irregular hours.
I only went out when I was called out there. I could get a call at 9 o'clock at night. Actually, I got a call once at 11:30 at night, and they stated, we would like you down at McCarran Airport by 12:15. How do you tell your wife, you know, you're in bed, you get a call, okay, I got to go. Well, what is it? Oh, it's my job. I don't know if I'm going to be coming back until tomorrow.
By this point, Lazar says, he had worked at Area 51 for 4 months and felt he could no longer abide by his confidentiality agreement. At sundown on Wednesday, March 22, 1989, Lazar, his wife, and three friends drive to the edge of Area 51 to watch the test flight of a saucer.
The craft was typically only tested on a Wednesday night because it was the middle of the week, because there was very little travel on the adjacent highways to the test site.
Around 8 p.m., the group notices a bright light rising behind a mountain pass in the distance.
It came towards us very fast and made an abrupt 90-degree turn.
Oh, my God.
Lazar's friends are awestruck by the object's erratic maneuvers.
Nothing can make a 90-degree turn moving at hundreds of miles an hour. And that's what left an impression in everyone's mind.
According to Lazar, the alien ship hovers for a few more moments before it disappears behind the mountains. The following Wednesday night, Lazar and his group return to the same spot in the desert.
Since we got away with it the first time, we wanted to go back and now actually get pictures of the craft. But, you know, it's like filming a star at night. It's just a blob of light moving around.
1 week later, they make a third nighttime foray to Area 51. This time, however, they've pushed their luck too far.
The security guys had found us, and it's pitch black out.
The armed guards check their IDs and take their names before releasing them. As they leave, Lazar and his friends are pulled over by a Lincoln County Sheriff's deputy who holds them for questioning. The next day, Lazar asserts, Dennis Mariani and Area 51 security agents threaten him.
One of the first things they said was, you know, when we trusted you with this information, we didn't mean, you know, intend for you to tell everyone you know about it. They guard held an M16 directly in my face and, you know, wanted to impress upon me how serious they were about it.
According to Lazar, he is released and his employment at Area 51 ends. From then on, he says, he becomes the victim of a relentless campaign of intimidation.
I was driving down Charleston Boulevard in Las Vegas, and as I came to the freeway on-ramp, there was a car that kept trying to get alongside of me. I heard a gunshot, and it caught my attention, and there was a guy in the car with a gun. I went straight, went off the end, and stopped in the dirt. I was really just paralyzed in the car. I was holding the steering wheel, and I thought he was coming up alongside of me, and there was just nothing I can do.
It is at this point that Lazar decides to take his story to the public in an interview with KLAS-TV reporter George Knapp. In May of 1989, he appears in silhouette on the 5 o'clock local news.
I did go on the air and basically say some of the stuff that I had seen. Right after the interview, I get a call from Dennis Mariani at home, and he said, do you have any idea what we're going to do to you now? And I said, no, what? And he hung up the phone.
I'm a technology person. I'm a hardware person. I'm not a UFO nut. I believe Bob Lazar because Bob Lazar, you know, told a believable story and has never altered it.
Goodall is persuaded in part by what appears to be solid evidence that Lazar did work for the military, a yearly earnings statement from 1988 to 1989. According to Lazar, his W-2 tax form was issued by the, quote, Department of Naval Intelligence. There is, however, no such known Department of Government. In 1990, during Operation Desert Shield, Goodall is on active duty in Washington, D.C. with the Minnesota Air National Guard. He decides to check on the validity of Lazar's W-2 form and goes to the Navy's investigative office in the Pentagon.
I went into the Department of Naval Investigation in the Pentagon. And I said, I'd like a verification of where this location is. It's a classified zip code. And the Navy officer said, just a minute, and made a phone call. He said, you know, the Admiral would like to see you.
Close the door, Sergeant.
So I go into this Admiral's office, and he said, Sergeant, if you ever come in this office again with something like this, I'll have you court-martialed. Now get out of my office and get out of here now. If his W-2 was phony, why did this Admiral have a hissy fit over it?
Transparency of Groom Lake. Groom Lake is where the infamous Area 51, S4, S2, a CIA base, it was originally a bombing range, a nuclear test site. It was later become the most secret base in the United States. It employs over 18,000 workers who work in shifts of 12 hours at a whack. Most of them work in the cover of darkness, like us. We built nine underground military bases there, each with an average capacity, capable of basically a city underground, roughly 4.25 cubic miles hollowed out underground. They have boring machines, for instance. They don't bore. They literally vitrify and melt the rock, deflagrate the rock. It's a very sophisticated laser melting and deflagrating system. It reduces the rock to a powder and then melts the remaining rock as a coating on the inside of the base, so you don't have to use gunite, cements, and other kinds of things like that. That's all old hat now. Technology is just basically the new technology we get is the old hat of the military. I'm going to be real brief about it. I carried a level 1 security clearance, the Rylite 38 Factor. There are very few of us. There's nobody except myself, to my knowledge, talking like this. Nobody. I'm breaking the law. I'm breaking world as well as federal law. I'm coming out and even talking about this to a group of people. I love my country more than I love my life. 2 weeks ago, I was shot in the shoulder. I don't want to gore you women out, but I was shot in the shoulder up here. I recently have become friends of a retired FBI agent who took me under the wing. He says, I've never seen a person braver than you. And I said, well, there's more coming. Our patriot movement in these United States is going to pick up the ball, and we are going to kick the parasites out. First of all, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, a few other founding fathers, Patrick Henry to mention a few, all had visions that these United States is going to live 700 years from where they were standing, and that was somewhere around the late 1700s, early 1800s. So you can count this country isn't going to go to a new world order. I believe firmly in constitutional law. I'm not very well skilled in it, and that's my embarrassment. But I'm going to be real blunt about it. The government that is now instilled in ruling over us are ruling as we're serfs and they're the kings and queens. Now, that's a feudal system. That isn't even a democracy. We are now being ruled by an autocracy and a technocracy. In other words, technical knowledge is rules as king with a feudal type system. Feudal systems haven't been used in the last 350 years. And they're coming back like gangbusters. If we are complacent, if we do not speak out in droves, and I'm not just talking about me, I'm talking about a bunch of us getting together and getting on the stump and loving our country more than we love our lives, getting on, some of us are going to get killed. I almost got killed a couple of weeks ago. I hadn't been for had been for an FBI, a retired FBI man, who risked his life, his career, everything, put it all on the line, and he didn't know me from Adam. A week prior to that, he listened to one of my tapes I gave up in Post Falls, Idaho, and I'm going to be very blunt about, he said that we need a lot more of you, but unfortunately we're not getting anybody. Well, I'm not the best speaker in the world, but I'm trying to relay to you that we need to get out and seriously get the message out. These shows are great. This hall should be absolutely packed, standing room only, and we should be getting the message out to as many people as we can with as many shows as there are, is it possibly to reach, the many is the public. We ought to get on talk shows. We've got to get on news shows and TV shows, and we have to really get the message out. And I think we're doing it, but it's a little bit slow in the first part. That's just that part of what I want to say. In working with the Black Projects, I was very loyal. I was picked because I was very strong mentally. There's a bunch of us that were picked because we don't crack under pressure. We don't freak under pressure, so to speak. Everyday events don't bother us. Now, I was involved in something very controversial, almost totally unbelievable to most of you. Some of you are religious people. I think all religions have a time and a place, and they definitely have a place in America. Now, another thing I want to reach to you is that during the unbelievable part, I was involved in building another base inside of Dulce, New Mexico, which is Los Alamos Laboratory. It's a biological laboratory. On the southwest part of the Archuleta Mesa, we built an underground facility, a better part of 3 cubic miles, hollowed out underground. Then to the southwest of that, we were in the process of the early stages of building. We drilled 4 large tunnel-like holes. Some of them ran 2.5 miles under the surface. Wells or drilling machines that were used were at the rate of 2 miles a day. It was fairly rapid. The equipment kept coming up broken, so we wanted to go down. We wanted to send somebody down there, a human observer, or human observers in this case, to find out what was going on. Well, to our total surprise, first of all, the government knew all about it. They didn't tell anybody. When I saw Green Beret and Black Beret people encamped inside of our geologist camp, I knew something was up. The gig was up. First of all, I knew all about the alien agenda. I'll explain that in a few minutes. The large alien grays had been encamped there for as best as believed possible about 400 or 500 years. It had been one of their internal bases. And we'd drilled holes right on top of it. All the stinking air, all the black sooty air came right out as soon as the first hole was sunk, and all this soot came up, and well, that's when it all the hell broke loose, really, all started. Anyway, after we drilled all 4 holes, it took about 2 days to drill all 4 of them, and when you build a underground base, you drill 4 basic holes, and then you build, called stopes or cross-member holes across, and then you use blasting equipment, and special blasting equipment by the analyzation of the rock formation, and you literally blast out or tunnel out or deflagrate or melt rock out to build the large rooms that are required for this underground base. Well, in this process, I was lowered down the basket of one of these holes, and about from me to this elderly woman here in the front was sitting a 7-foot-tall alien gray. The stench was worse than the worst garbage can you can imagine. The person was the entity was absolutely horrible. I didn't waste any time. I reached for my pistol. At that time, as an engineer, I didn't have time to carry all the folder, all of one of these big submachine guns that all the sea spray and the yellow fruit and all the outer perimeter and inner perimeter security people carried. I carried old Walther PPK pistol with a 9-shot clip. This was in late August of 1979. Now, you got a regular suit of clothes, you got a regular clothes on, plus you're in a almost like a spacesuit environment, and you're reaching for a gun. It's not the easiest thing to do, and then to pop a clip in it and start shooting. And I killed two of them. Yes, they're mortal, and they do die. However, in the process...
Okay, this was a gentleman by the name of Phil Snyder, who after delivering this particular piece of information was assassinated immediately after delivering this information that we just heard. Area code 704.
Let's see what these mechanics looking at.
Oh, yeah.
We got an hour from push right now, so we'll go out.
Okay. All right. He busy doing something else.
The state, Bastiat wrote, is that great fiction by which everyone seeks to live at the expense of everyone else. The French economist penned those words before he was able to witness another great fiction, which currently works to undermine all labor and all the accumulated wealth of every American and, by extension, virtually every laboring individual on this planet. We all work for this fiction every day. People beg for this fiction. Many borrow from others to obtain this fiction. Some even kill so that they can unlawfully accumulate more of this fiction. Without this fiction, you could have no clothing for your back, no roof over your head, and no food for your stomach. That great fiction is the American dollar. You can pull a note out of your pocket and examine it, but you would be searching in vain for any intrinsic value. The value is not found in the ink, nor the material in which the ink is impregnated, nor in the wording. In fact, the wording provides the hint you'll need to begin to realize that there is nothing in and of itself that imputes any value into this piece of paper. Nothing, that is, but a construct of belief. Oh, and one other thing, brute force. But we'll get to that later. Our dollar's history begins with Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. It states that Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and fix the standards of weights and measures. In 1792, the Coinage Act was passed, establishing a mint and regulating the coins of the United States. This law created and defined America's money. It called for a coin called the dollar to contain about 3/4 of an ounce of silver. It also called for a half dollar, quarter, dime, and half dime, all made of silver. It called for a coin called an eagle, each worth $10 and containing a half an ounce of gold. It also called for a half eagle and a quarter eagle, all made of gold. Each coin, according to this act, would bear an impression of liberty, the word liberty, and the year of coinage. The reverse side shall have an impression of an eagle with the inscription United States of America. So the definition of money was a silver coin of the United States of the value of 1/10 of an eagle, or $1. An eagle was defined as a gold coin of the United States of the value of $10. For the first 80 years of our history, these coins were known as lawful money. In 1794, the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia began minting coins. This is what they looked like. They were strictly composed of either gold or silver, painstakingly fashioned to the proper weight. So strict was the standard on weights and measures, and so serious was the language of the U.S. Coinage Act, that Section 19 invoked the death penalty for anyone caught debasing the nation's money. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution states, No state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender of payment of debts. Emit bills of credit equates to the issuance of unbacked paper promissory notes as money. America's entire economy was anchored to gold and silver by requiring the states to tender all payments in these coins. Some leaders today, however, claim that gold is not money.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
This gold and silver standard stood as a protection for the people from the corrupt banksters who love to loan out money they don't have and profit from the interest. Such a debasing practice known as fractional reserve banking is outright counterfeiting and therefore theft. The gold system ensured that the nation's wealth was distributed to all the people rather than being centralized in the hands of a few. It constrained governments from issuing unbacked notes of debt, which is what the Federal Reserve note is today. In fact, many, including Benjamin Franklin, held that a dishonest money system was a main reason for the Revolutionary War. He wrote, "The refusal of King George III to allow the colonies to operate an honest money system, which freed the ordinary man from the clutches of the money manipulators, was probably the prime cause of the revolution." Two central banks materialized in early America in order to manipulate the nation's money supply. The First Bank of the United States was established in 1791, in spite of opposition from people like Thomas Jefferson, who argued against its constitutionality and wrote, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." The First Bank's charter was revoked by James Madison. In 1816, the Second Bank of the U.S. was formed. Andrew Jackson, sworn enemy of the central bank, despised the thought of private bankers controlling America's money. Its charter was revoked in 1833. Gold's discovery in California in 1849 caused the mint to add a $1 tenth gold eagle and a $20 double gold eagle in order to distribute the gold across the population, honoring the founder's principle of decentralizing power by spreading the wealth. The presence and universal acceptance of gold shackled private bankers and severely limited inflation. It's interesting to note that in the 57 years from 1833 to 1890, gold, priced at $20.67 an ounce, fluctuated only one penny. And from 1891 to 1930, gold fluctuated just 74 cents from a low of $20.58 to a high of $21.32. In 1861, individual rights trampling president Abraham Lincoln financed the War of Northern Aggression by printing unbacked paper money, an act that debased America's money and, according to the Coinage Act of 1792, placed him under penalty of death. During this criminal act, the Treasury reeled in coins and replaced them with Lincoln's greenback. These notes were denominated in both dollars and cents, and virtually all of America's money was converted to paper. In just 4 years, nearly 100% of the gains in the standard of living and the purchasing power of the dollar had been wiped out, along with over 600,000 lives. After the war, the mint resumed coining money. The dollar gained value, even going through periods of increased buying power. In 1866, contrary to the Constitution, they replaced the silver dime with a 5-cent nickel, allowing them to quickly replenish their silver reserves. Unfortunately, the U.S. government was still issuing paper dollars in the form of notes. Here, an 1878 $20 note reads, "This note is legal tender at its face value for all debts, public and private, except duties on imports and interest on the public debt." In other words, neither foreign nations nor the international bankers who financed them would accept this as money. Because it wasn't money. It was a note, a loan, an IOU. It was debt. The creators of this debt are saying, you can use it as money among yourselves, but don't try to pay us with it. All money created out of thin air is debt. They expect you to accept that debt as a fair trade for your labor while they reject that debt for themselves. In the 1880s, the Treasury began issuing a new kind of paper money called silver and gold certificates. The legalese on these certificates reads, "This certifies that there has been deposited in the Treasury of the United States one silver dollar, payable to the bearer on demand." Each silver certificate represented one physical silver or gold coin in the Treasury. This bill says nothing about a note because it isn't an IOU. There is no restriction on imports or interest on the public debt. Foreign nations and international bankers would accept this as money because it was money. However, if the government decreed that they will no longer honor that certificate, you are left with nothing but a fancy-looking piece of paper. The early 1900s brought men like J.P. Morgan to the forefront. Morgan, publicly considered a financial luminary at the time, exploited his mass influence by publishing rumors that a prominent bank in New York was insolvent. Morgan knew this would cause mass hysteria, which would affect other banks as well. And it did. The public, in fear of losing their deposits, immediately began mass withdrawals. Consequently, the banks were forced to call in their loans, causing the recipients to sell their property. Thus, a spiral of bankruptcies, repossessions, and turmoil emerged. Frederick Allen of Life magazine would later write, "The Morgan interest took advantage to precipitate the panic of 1907, guiding it shrewdly as it progressed." The 1907 financial crisis that caused the New York Stock Exchange to lose 50% from the previous year prompted the people to beg the government to break the grip of the money trust. This paved the way for Morgan and his allies to step in with the solution to the problem they created. And on December 23, 1913, the Federal Reserve was born. The Federal Reserve, a cartel of international banking counterfeiters and money manipulators, began printing Federal Reserve notes, a government-sanctioned banknote. This note, like the greenbacks which preceded it, was a demand note. It was redeemable for gold, but only in Washington or at a member bank. If you lived far away, it was highly unlikely that you would redeem this paper for the precious metal. The note itself admits that it is not lawful money. Something that can be exchanged for lawful money is not lawful money itself. 19 years after the Fed's creation, FDR, another counterfeit-enabling president, also subject to the criminal penalty of death according to the Coinage Act of 1792, demonetized gold, ending the production of gold coins, certificates, and silver dollars in order to stimulate the economy. He allowed the Fed to print notes that were not redeemable for lawful money. 1 year later, in April of 1933, FDR issued Executive Order 6102, requiring all persons under the threat of $10,000 fine and up to 10 years in prison or both to deliver on or before May 1, 1933, their gold coins, bullion, and gold certificates to the Federal Reserve in exchange for $20.67 in Federal Reserve paper. After the confiscation of gold and the criminalization of those holding it, gold was raised 60% to $35 an ounce, resulting in an immediate loss for those who had surrendered the precious metal. America's leaders had stolen the labor and true wealth of her citizens and replaced it with worthless paper. 11 years later, in 1944, while World War II continued to rage, 730 delegates from all 44 Allied nations gathered at Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, to establish rules for commercial and financial relations among the world's industrial states. Because of the economic and physical devastation inflicted on virtually every country involved in the war, and because the U.S. emerged from that conflict as an economic and military powerhouse in possession of an estimated 50% of the world's known gold, the Bretton Woods Agreement replaced the British pound and established the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. This meant that international commodities were priced in dollars. The agreement, which gave the U.S. an incredible financial advantage, was made under the condition that those dollars would remain redeemable for gold at a consistent rate of $35 per ounce. But with the unrestricted, unregulated, 30-year-old Federal Reserve fox watching over the gold-filled henhouse and its greedy fingers itching to print more notes, those nations would soon discover that entrusting your nation's wealth to a nation that had already ripped off its own citizens was a financially destructive act. If you'd like to see more videos like this, please subscribe to this channel.
When it comes to student loans, sometimes things are a little bit tricky. You have to understand that you cannot discharge a student loan through bankruptcy. This contract has to be canceled. We have some special documentation specifically designed for getting rid of the student loan and also dealing with the child support. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and if you have child support situation or if you have a student loan, you want to access the Get Rid of the Student Loan package. It is designed for dealing with both of them. Along with that package comes Tahaka Archives Master Library, so you'll be thoroughly equipped to deal with this situation and go on to deal with other situations that may be occurring in your life. The bottom line is to detach yourself from these income sapping situations that you have been put into by Rome. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, access to get rid of the student loan package. That is a major problem that's going on inside the United States, and the way to eliminate that problem is located there. When you get to newfreehelpgroup.com, examine that page, click on the link, www.tahakaarchives.org. That'll take you right over there where the packages are. If you click under the little wording under the photograph, a little drop down menu will come in and give you additional information. However, once you do that, if you decide to do that, give me a call at area code 904-303-9061, and we would get with you and give you any other additional information that you would need in dealing with the cancellation of the contract on your student loan, okay?
All of us in this room get caught in the spider web, and I'm the only one that the spider chooses to eat. No, we all in this together. You understand what I'm saying? One of Wesley Snipes' movie, I forget which one it was, one of the characters said, you know, CMB, the Cash Money Brothers, we all we got. So y'all better get used to the idea. We're going to have to lock arms and become and get in sync with those of us that just don't necessarily look like us. Get f***ing used to it. The war is on. You understand what I'm saying? So when I turn to a brother of mine like Alex Jones without looking back, if I say, look, bro, pass the ammo, then pass the f***ing ammo. And you can't deny the fact that Alex Jones at Infowars.com, Prison Planet, or whatever entity it is, did he not pass the ammo? Yes, look at what we have here. Corporatism, a system of control designed by the monopoly men of the global elite. Now, this wasn't written by Professor Griff. And it talks about 47 million Americans are now on food stamps in the middle class. It talks about how China... China is creating these particular robots that are taking over the jobs, not in China, in America. So when we go into false flags, and as we talked about earlier, we talk about the United States, the U.S., and there's a difference between the U.S. and the USA. Google U.S. versus the USA, and you call me and tell me what you come up with. Anyway, this document here says U.S. and Al-Qaeda, which we know Al-Qaeda was something manufactured and made up by the CIA as the boogeyman. And there always has to be a boogeyman with every president that sits in the seat. There always has to be a boogeyman that they're fighting. Well, we need to figure out who's the boogeyman for Barack H. Obama. This says the best frenemies. Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA, and it's a 20-page document, and it goes into how Barack Obama was groomed by the CIA to do exactly what he's doing. Now, If you see and you look real close, we're going to talk about the media in a minute. If you look real close at what George Bush Jr. set in motion in Eurasia and other places that Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about in his book, you don't see a dime worth a damn difference what George Bush Jr. said in the 8 years of him stumbling through his pregnancy in the White House. You don't see a damn bit of difference than what Barack Obama is doing today. As a matter of fact, it's worse what Barack Obama is doing, simply because some of those things that Barack Obama should have came into office and erased, eradicated, and undid what George Bush Jr. set in motion, what Barack Obama has done. I heard Dick Gregory say that if you see some of the tricks that the CIA are pulling across the global landscape, shit, that's going to make Hitler blush. It's f***ing ridiculous. The mass murders that are going on to establish democracy in these places, and then when it comes to the media, listen, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about those sincere, real, hardworking photojournalists and journalists like you guys that are out there getting the real story and the story that's behind the scenes. But we rarely hear from you guys on a global scale, on a sound bite that's put on repeat on CNN every 10 minutes, that's playing through the airphones and on people's airport and on people's phones. We rarely get that. We have to create websites, mirror websites, send out information through the phones and through phone apps and this kind of thing to directly reach the people. Gun control. We have to talk about the amendments. Now, just once again, I'm not playing the race card. When we talk about the Constitution or Constipation of the United States of America, you have to understand it means something different to white Europeans as it means to black people. The reason why we call ourselves public enemy. The whole idea of black people being written in as three-fifths of a human being. Now, what kind of bullshit is that? I mean, the tape is rolling, but we're just speaking, having a fireside chat right now. How in the hell can I respect the Constitution that wrote me in subhuman? So then when we go look at the Constitution, we can honestly say that a pig, man, an animal is whole pig, five-fifths pig. A snake, a gerbil, a damn fly is a whole fly, a whole cow, a whole pig, five-fifths. But when it comes to black people that gave birth to everyone on the planet, and we can debate that, you write black people in as three-fifths of a human being, and then you want to try to amend it as though that's cool? That's like doing a Puffy remix on the Constitution. Out of here. I'm not buying into it. So when we talk about rights, black people have no rights in America because we're not human. We're subhuman. So then when we stand up and speak to these particular things, we're speaking from a different perspective than white people. And we need to understand it. But the beautiful thing I like about what's going on, especially with what Alex Jones is doing, is the fact that all of us are in the same boat. So get used to it, white people. You got to start living like black people have been living. And I'm laughing about it simply because now the gender, the race lines have been blurred now to the point where we're forced to work together. Now, you're forced to see it how we see it, and we're forced to see it how you see it. Now, what are we going to do? Be ignorant and keep arguing over the race card and the race issue? No. We have to come together on some real issues that affect us all, regardless of your complexion. We have to understand it and understand it from black people, my perspective, and a heartfelt black point of reference. Because if I say I support the Second Amendment, then we move on to the third, fourth, fifth, then it becomes a problem. Because my was going to get caught in a web that wasn't designed for me to get the out of. Okay, let's just be honest and let's talk. After all of it's said and done, we're sovereign, we're over the hill, we don't have to look back, that door's closed. Can I actually hook up with other people that's not my complexion, and we could put something in place where all of us are sovereign and we can have arms and enjoy the rights and the freedoms that everyone else on the planet enjoys? You right, who wouldn't want that? As a human, I would want that, plain and simple. But we don't have that today in America, now do we? Listen, law is only as good as the people enforcing the law. Am I correct? So that if they're not going to support, protect, defend, honor, uphold the very same law that they put in place, what good is it? George Bush Sr. and Jr. on the Constitution. Am I right or wrong? And there's only a handful of people that spoke up. And the majority of them sold the out and took the payoff. Plain and simple. And then the ones that did speak up, the brave white people that did speak up, to speak to other white people, because I can't speak to the vast majority of white people. I can through my songs, through the Public Enemy medium of hip-hop and music, and a lot of young white people get it. But these old who refuse to give up the whole idea of having black people be inclusive and share the benefit of what the Second Amendment has to offer, out of here. It ain't gonna happen. Hidden histories of all the president's guns. April 1963, President and General Chester V. Clifton inspect M16 assault weapon. But then it goes down. I'm skipping down now. There's a picture here of President John F. Kennedy, April of 1960. It says, by calling attention to a well-regulated militia, the security of the nation and the right of each citizen to keep and bear arms, our founding fathers recognized the essentially civilian nature of our economy. Although it is extremely unlikely that the fears of the governmental tyranny which gave rise to the Second Amendment will ever be a major danger in our nation, go figure, right? The amendment still remains an important declaration of our basic civilian military relationships, in which every citizen must be ready to participate in the defense of his country. For that reason, I believe that the Second Amendment will always be important. That's John F. Kennedy, April 1960. How important is that particular quote in 2013 as we sit here and as we speak today? Every citizen, wait a minute, that includes all the illegal aliens that you claim are illegal in America, all right? That you at the stroke of a pen, that Barack Obama can make all these people legal? Are you talking about the disenfranchised segments of the black community that who are under this three-strike law have no rights anymore? Are you talking about convicted felons who have no voice? Who are you talking about that every citizen? Who do you consider a citizen? There's rights being taken away right now as we speak. And according to the particular laws that they're passing, you have no voice because they don't consider you a citizen. We need to understand it. So when you're looking at the hidden histories of all presidents and their guns, just for example, this gold-plated AR-15 presented to President Kennedy by the Colt Firearms back in the day. This is an actual gold-plated, this is a gold-plated gun that was presented to President Kennedy. Down here, there was a gold-plated from the Colt factory, a gold-plated handgun that was presented to Wilson at the particular time. So you mean to tell me that the gun manufacturers are not in bed with some of these people in the White House? Come on, we can go through a history of people owning guns. Here's Elvis presenting Nixon with a gun. But this is not the important thing. We need to talk about the guns that are on the street, that was put on the street when you go through operations like Operation Garden Plot. When you talk about the CIA covert operation in black America, just in America, period. We can do a history of CIA covert operations in America. And how many guns are on the street and been put on the street by the government herself. And then we can take account of that, and then we can say to ourselves, okay, well, who the hell put the guns on the street in the first place? So when you talk about the Second Amendment and who actually has rights, let me tell you something. There's people that own guns right now that will never have rights in America. But they're using them every single day. And I swear, and y'all just chime in on this. You mean to tell me we looked at what happened in Boston for the last week? They admitted several times, and I don't know if you guys are listening, but they went door to door, black boots, kicking doors in, man. That's what's to come. That's what's happening right now as we speak. They're going to kick your door in like they're going to kick mine in. The people that control the media could probably fit right in this room with snacks, right or wrong. You're not talking about, you talk about gigantic corporations, but you're talking about a handful of people that control everything that we see, everything that we hear, everything that we touch. And I don't care if it's a movie that comes out, a magazine, a trend. They control it all. You probably have 0.0001% of information that gets out through brave souls and individuals.
Okay, Moses, we come to the end of the broadcast, and we're going to come back in the future with some more of this type of information. There's a ton of information, but we just don't have the time to bring it all out now, and I appreciate you all for listening to what we've presented here this evening. Keep in mind that for free articles that's mentioned on this broadcast, just send me an email, say, Taco. Send me those free articles, and I'll rush it to you by email. Send that to tahaka53@hotmail.com. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com, and we'll get that to you. And don't forget, also, in the month of January, we'll have the Murray Summit happening right here in Jacksonville, Florida. So mark that on your calendar and stay tuned for future broadcasts, because we're going to deliver all of the how-to information and what will be going on at the summit and all this stuff. So make sure that you tune in to Morris Talk Live 100 right here with me, Tahaka Amana Elbe, as we discuss that and give you all the details of that event that will be coming up here in January. That's held twice a year, in January and again in August. So we're going to do it in January, so that's right around the corner. Make sure that you mark your calendar for that event and stay tuned for all the details. Okay. Also, once again, for those of you who are on your social sites, if you're on your social sites, if you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, they keep me banned over there. I try to send out invitations to events today, and I could not send one single event invitation out. I was blocked, you know, it was amazing. If I befriend someone, they told me they would permanently ban me, and never seen anything like it. But I'm not surprised, because I've been a victim of this as a person of African descent for 400 years inside the country, so I'm not surprised. But anyway, I want to add, for those of you who like to register with your government, go to www.moorishamericangov.org. That's www.moorishamericangov.org. census.org and put your name on and information in there on the census form. And once you do that, you can dial into the national conference calls. It's held 7 days a week. And that number is located over there for you to call in. And the best time to call is starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with the Moorish American Government. I will be out in Texas within the next month or so, and then we will also be heading over to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then I'll be down in back into the Florida Keys again coming up this year. And but we're going to continue to do the broadcast. I'm going to try to my best to do these broadcasts from my locations so that we won't miss a beat and we can keep this information coming. And keep in mind, on your social, if you're on Facebook or whatever, go over to my groups. We have our Tahaka New Moorish American group, what else we got? Tahaka's Institute and other groups there, Tahaka Moorish American men and women. And these groups, you can go ahead and join these groups. There's a ton of information on there. There's a ton of videos and stuff there and articles and stuff and actual documents that you can use to accomplish a lot of things that you want to accomplish. It's power of attorney documents, stuff don't cost you a dime. Just go in there, copy and paste that sucker, print it off, type your information in there, take out the John Doe, put your information in, and just use it. I want you to stay tuned in the future for more informative information coming to you on Blog Talk Radio. On Moorish Talk Live 100, just click on the educational system, educational link there, and we'll listen on the education so that you will be able to stay abreast of what new information that we're bringing out. For those of you who have problems with your mortgage, if you got problems with student loans, child support, if you got problems with credit card companies, whatever, go over to type in your HTTP information, type in www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and if you got these problems, give me a call so we can find out exactly what's going on so we can best help you with the situation that you have. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana LB, and until next time, y'all have a good evening.
Today's special is Memphis Soul Stew. We sell so much of this, people wonder what we put in it. We're going to tell you right now. Give me about a half a teacup of base. Now I need a pound of fat back drums. Now give me 4 tablespoons of ballin' Memphis guitars. This going to taste all right. Now just a little pinch of organ. Now give me a half a pint of horn. Place on the burner and bring to a boil. That's it right there. Now beat